has to pay the iron price.
He has to pay the iron price.
I'll never respect you while he lives.
Watch it all come around as I lay on the ground. Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn, Payne, the Hound. They all think I'm lost, but I know where I'm found. I'm the blood in the north when it all comes down. My word is my bond, and my bond is my word. Valar Dohaeris, all men must serve. See, as a raven flies, and time slips by. Valar Morghulis, all men must die.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast by BaldMove.com. We're the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's Game of Thrones television series. Tonight, we're covering episode 402, The Lion and the Rose. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And I don't have a lot of stuff to talk about pre-recap. Actually, I do.
Okay.
We've got our feeds issue with iTunes totally resolved. There is the one true feed. All the pretenders have been put down.
Yep.
With a series of dwarven combatants. It was it's I don't know why Apple does it that way. It's kind of insulting. Very efficient.
I had to contact them to get our new feed removed. I'm thinking about contacting them to also get Chin's feed removed.
Just to see if they'll do it.
Yeah, just to see if they'll do it.
All right, let's do it. apologies for the confusion, but now there's just the one there. So if you stumbled upon our website trying to find out where the iTunes feed is, you should be able to search Game of Thrones. We're probably the top three, one of the top three results. If we're slipping, throwing Bald Move, we'll be right at the top. So thanks for following us through that. Our temporary theme continues. This is a very divisive issue with our listeners. Some people say we're laying siege to their ears. Some people are loving it. But anyway, it's Arya's Prayer by Dominic Omega. You can get the entire Catch the Throne album, the HBO commissioned, at soundcloud.com/catchthethrone. Because, again, it will not be here for long. As soon as we can find originally licensed music, we're going to be replacing it. Let's get right to The Lion and the Rose, because we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, Jim.
Okay.
The Lion and the Rose was directed by Game of Thrones veteran Alex Graves and written by George R.R. Martin himself.
Wow.
The germ climbed down from the Iron Throne, took a few weeks off of writing The Wind of Winter, and wrote this episode.
I think he's taken more than a few weeks off.
Because, you know, he's got nothing better to do. There's no multi-million dollar television series breathing down his neck. Got $6.3 million, which is slightly down from last week's $6.64. But that's usually what happens after premiere. And it'll probably stabilize and recover finish off bigger and better, especially when people hear that the real shit happened in season or episode two.
Yeah, I was wondering, do those numbers count like iTunes downloads?
No.
And Amazon views? I don't even know if it's on Amazon.
I believe...
How about HBO Go?
I believe it only counts the original airing and the second airing on HBO 2, because they do an encore.
Yeah.
So they add those up for each of the three time zones, and that's the total listeners. It does include HBO Go or, of course, online piracy or anything like that.
I wonder if someone could tell me when the episode exactly comes out on HBO Go, because I looked immediately after the episode was over, and it was there. So I want to know if it comes out day and date with
I actually heard sometimes it comes out before.
Before?
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. So I don't even need... So I can watch HBO Go wherever I am.
I don't know, because I've never watched it that way. But I've heard there's been some occasions where it's come out hours before.
I wonder if that's people on the West Coast who get it on Eastern time. Because
I don't think so.
We get 3 hours early.
I think people are smart enough to understand that. But anyway,
yeah, I think so too.
if that's the primary way you watch it and you've got some hard data on that, let us know, because I'm kind of curious myself. If I could time shift my watching and have the instant cast out that much quicker, that would be good for it. We could record
or when
it.
I'm on the road, I can actually
record
watch
it
on HBO
and
Go.
Drop it right at 10 o'clock and boom, you can't get much more instant than that. It at 9 o'clock as soon as the episode airs, people can watch it with us. That's a terrible way to watch Game of Thrones. I don't recommend it. Let's get into the recap. We open with the Ramses going a hunting, a woman named Tansy. Ramsay says to his girlfriend Miranda to be very, very quiet.
Okay.
That did not happen. But they do hunt her down, rip her apart with dogs. What do you think of this scene? What are we learning about the Boltons we didn't know before.
I don't think there's a damn thing I learned about the Boltons that I didn't know before. Except maybe who this girl is that's by his side, because, well, A, I don't think there are any Boltons in this scene, are there?
That's true.
There are
some Snows and some Mirandas and some Greyjoys.
Yeah.
Half Greyjoys. Just Grey, no Joy.
No Joy in there whatsoever. I don't know. It seems to me like, yeah, he's a vicious guy. Scene closed.
I also liked that Alfie Allen is just smashing his portrayal of Reek here, because in the book, this is an amalgam of different scenes, but they always mention that he has this weird stumbling gait because Ramsay's cut off so many of his toes that he doesn't have much foot stability.
Jeez, I hadn't even thought of that.
And yeah. Just kind of, he has like this really twitchy, sallow, malnourished behavior now that I think is great. Long way to go to get to this particular scene or performance, but I'll save that. I'm going to put a pin in the topic about Theon's brokenness until we get to the next scene.
Those performances are always the most rewarding when it does take a while to get to them, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what you want to see, character development. I'm just saying, point
from,
of it.
From a standpoint of the people bitching about continually cutting to the Dreadfort last season for the latest edition of Theon's humiliation, was it really necessary? I don't know. That'll be a topic that we can talk about here in about two or three scenes.
Okay.
Moving on to the next one, Jaime and Tyrion having some kind of lunch.
Sure.
That's another nice smash cut.
It includes wine, so we don't know. Could it be breakfast? Yeah, why not?
You know, Tyrion's a professional drunk, so it could be breakfast for all we know. It does contain sausages, which was a nice little smash cut from Theon to the sausage.
Yep.
Wonder how long they're going to keep doing that. But they're talking, they're commiserating how they're now the dwarf, the cripple, and the mother of madness as far as their three children of Tywin. Jaime is worried that he can no longer protect the king, that he's not really a full knight. And he's got this concern about training, because who would he train with? Who can he trust not to blab his big secret? And he thinks, I mean, what do you think his chief concern? He's still Jaime fucking Lannister. Lord of the Kingsguard.
There are a couple of concerns here. I think, he doesn't feel like Jaime anymore because he doesn't have his hand. B, how can he command respect when these guys know he can't fight and he says as much in the scene?
Right.
And C, I don't know that he has commanded in the past, right?
And that's a good point. I mean, I think he's commanded, like, on the field.
Okay.
But you got to wonder what he is like as a commander. You know, is he more just like, I lead by my badass example?
Seems like that. That was the vibe I got.
Not a lot of planning. You know, I'm just going to get my father's vanguard and fuck shit up kind of a strategy. The other thing is, I think that there's a little bit of blood in the water aspect here.
How so?
That, you know, a lot of people have a certain amount of contempt and jealousy, contempt for Jaime as a Kingslayer, and general jealousy of the Lannisters in general. And if it became known that he was helpless as a newborn babe, I think, you know, there's, especially if you're the first one to figure that out and decided to kill him, you would instantly get this huge, like the guy that shot Wyatt Earp or something.
Yeah, big reputation.
You get a lot of cachet from being the guy that killed the Kingslayer.
Yeah. So there's incentive to kill him as well.
Right.
Now that he's crippled, it's maybe possible.
So Tyrion has the perfect solution, which is hiring Bronn. Before we leave the scene, though, I love the Chekhov's wine glass that Tyrion knocks over, spills, or Jaime does with his clumsy hand. Not coordinated, not used to that. And Tyrion just lifts it up and pours it on the table. It's like, it's just wine. Yet that has so many, wine has so many repercussions later on in the series.
Oh, yeah.
Or in this episode, rather.
There are a couple of other small things in the scene I want to talk about real quick.
Go for it.
Jaime's hand.
Yeah.
Beyond belief at this point, to me, him being a Lannister, is not gold. Tyrion says it is gilded steel. What the hell is happening there? Shouldn't it be gold?
I would think that if it was solid gold, it would weigh like 20, 30 pounds.
Probably, but come on.
And if
he's
it was,
a Lannister.
It's not that he can't afford it.
I know.
You can't, like, gold is really malleable. So if it was like a thin shell gold for weight, it would just deform and, you know, it's very ductile.
Sure.
And it clearly can't just be steel.
Yeah.
Because it's Jaime Lannister. So, guilt. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It's
more impressive it makes than gilded sense, wood. But seeing it, I thought, oh, that's gold. And then when he said it, I was like, that, It's
again,
not very Lannister-y of him.
It would be an interesting... it would be a weapon in its own right if it was solid gold.
Yeah.
It would just basically be a flail, or a mace, rather, attached to his hand.
Yeah, imagine a slap from Jaime.
Should break teeth and jaws.
Also, the other little thing... I thought it was just funny that Cersei is now eating a lot of pig.
Oh, yeah.
Tyrion comments on that. I thought that was kind of cool.
That's another book detail. She's really taken to loving the pork and loving the wine since Robert's dead.
Yeah.
And we see that's a question the readers are asking about Cersei and her relationship with other people that we'll get to in the feedback section. But I think it's interesting to chart the evolution of her character. Like, you know, what path has she been on since she started to get the things that she wants most? Has it been a good path or a bad path?
Yeah.
Moving on to the proper discreet swordsman himself, Bronn and Jaime go to a secluded, I don't know what you would call it, fighting square by the sea.
It seemed to just be
area.
Some kind of balcony just looking over the sea.
It's like, right, you know, there's nothing but cliffs around, and he assures Jaime that there's no way they'll be discovered because he goes and fucks a Sir Laygood's wife down there, and she's
Sir Laygood or Sir Goodlay. That's what I'm wondering.
He's Laygood, she's Lady Goodlay.
Okay.
He's got thunderbolts on his shield. Anyway, we talked about this in Instant Cast. You know, Bronn kind of pretty much kicks his ass up and down, but I do think that Bronn's kind of messing with him. And it's interesting because Bronn's not teaching him swordsmanship so much. It's just giving him practice at doing the actual deed. Jaime knows how to do it. It's just his body doesn't have the muscle memory built up yet.
It also makes me wonder in this scene where Bronn is kind of like, oh, best time to attack a man is when he's not prepared. Is Jaime going to be a different kind of fighter at the end of this? Is he going to fight more like Bronn and less honorably?
That's a good point. One wonders how honorably Jaime fought in the first place, but,
sure,
but yeah, certainly Bronn can teach him a few dirty tricks.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to go around with one of his hunting daggers in the small of his back like Bronn.
At the end, he does seem to be determined to get better, I think.
He does.
He's like, okay, then, here we go.
Come at me. Come at me, bro. We go then to the north of the Dreadfort, where Ramsay comes to greet his father and his stepmom, who's riding into the fort. Ramsay's very polite and very courteous to his stepmom and to his lord father.
Yeah, he is. Is this Roose? Is that his name?
Roose Bolton, yeah.
Okay.
I also liked the parallels of Locke and Ramsay are kind of analogous to Benjen Stark and Jon Snow, that, like, Locke is his favorite uncle. They share dismemberment stories together.
Who is Locke?
He's the guy that cut off Jaime's hand.
Oh, okay.
That's his name. I didn't even know
it
until actually... I'm sure they've mentioned his name, but he's mentioned a couple times in episodes, so I actually wrote it down.
Sure.
But I thought they had that similar kind of relationship. It's like a funhouse version of the Starks or a horror... monster, what do you call that? A haunted house version of the Starks? And then what's kind of a bizarre edit, we go from, you know, Roose giving instructions about seeing his wife to her quarters and all this, to him just laying down and putting his head back against a chair. I thought that was really weird because there's nothing establishing the where we're at, why he's sitting in a chair. It's very un-Roose-like to just throw your head back and like, ah. Turns out that he was going to get a shave.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you see Locke, you know, with the strop and all that. But it really threw me, and I thought it was, I don't know what you would do better, but it was an uncharacteristically, I thought, sloppy edit and transition. Anyway, Roose just takes Ramsay to task, totally puts him in his place. Said these, you know, this isn't your banner. These are my banner. You're a Snow. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have treated with the Greyjoys without my permission. You shouldn't have hurt Theon because I need him as a hostage and a negotiating tactic. And now you've thrown away a lot of that. And he's right, because when we saw Balon didn't give two shits once he found out his dick was gone.
Yeah.
He's like, well, he's not a male heir anymore, so he's not even really my son.
Yeah.
But Ramsay demonstrates the potential use of what he's done to Theon when he sits down and offers up his neck to be shaved by Theon. And
nice little sentence there where Roose was saying, hey, you're not a Bolton. And he says, when he sits down, Roose looks a little worried, and he's like, what do you care? I'm not a Bolton.
And then, to his credit, Roose is like, all right, give him the knife.
Fair enough.
Fair point.
Yep.
But he reveals that Bran and Rickon are not dead.
Can I just say, I had no idea that the two crispy kids that hung up behind Theon last season were supposed to be Bran and Rickon.
I didn't?
Had no idea.
That was actually two seasons ago.
Two seasons ago. Okay. No idea whatsoever.
Interesting. I wonder if it's because you were binge watching and it just didn't stick in your mind, because that's a question that's immediately resolved in the next episode.
Huh? No,
but it was actually,
I probably
something
wasn't paying close enough attention.
It was something of a cliffhanger.
Okay.
Anyway, we find out that they're not dead, because that's not common knowledge. Lockett's tasked with hunting them down. Theon thinks that they might be at Castle Black, and Ramsay points out that Jon Snow's half Stark himself and could be a threat. A lot of process there. Bran and Rickon have targets painted on their back. We know Bran is probably safe north beyond the wall, but we don't. Last we knew that Asha was going to take Rickon off to one of the Bannermen, I think the Umbers. So he could still be vulnerable. And also, Locke going to Castle Black with the idea that Jon's a threat himself, that could put Castle Black in a very precarious situation. They're kind of caught between...
Stuck between three armies now. You've got Ygritte and her group.
Right.
Coming in from the south.
The main force north of the wall, and now you got these renegade Northmen.
And the White Walkers. I mean, there are so many forces converging on Castle Black now.
Yeah. But I thought... Here's the thing. I thought this shaving was a very effective demonstration of to the extent that Theon is broken, because in the books we have Theon's internal dialogue about just how pant-shittingly afraid and completely enthralled, but we needed something like this, and I don't know that we needed all the scenes of Theon's torture, but I think if like, say, half of them were there, people might be questioning about whether Theon would, in fact, not slit Ramsay's throat.
Yeah, I looking at the first scene in this episode where they're chasing that girl down, Theon definitely seems bothered by what's happening here. Obviously not enough to step in, and I think he's bothered by what Ramsay says here about killing Ned Stark. I think both of those things bother him, but obviously not enough to do anything about it. And this wasn't a very opportune time. If he kills Ramsay here, Roose jumps in and slices his... Well, I was going to say dick off, but I can't do that again.
Right. And I don't think that's the other thing. I don't think Theon's afraid of death. I think he's afraid of more pain.
Yeah.
Like
if he had a
dynamite vest strapped to him, I wouldn't trust him with the dead man switch.
Yeah.
But that, as you rightly point out, and I think that's one of the purposes of the scene we saw of Ramsay helping him to escape only to turn him back in, is that puts in Theon's mind that I could be tested to my loyalty and be utterly fooled. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the women, like this constantly like playing with the only thing you can be sure of is that Ramsay will hurt me if I don't do exactly what he'd want me to in every situation.
Yeah.
And even still, he'll probably hurt me anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's why he's not going to take the opportunity to, you know, take revenge, because in his mind, this is yet another test, and he's been conditioned just like an animal to respond to the test. So I've kind of come around a little bit on how critical I was of the scenes last year, because again, it's some stuff is very hard to do when you don't have the inner monologues that you've got in a piece of written fiction. Anyway, anything else to say?
there's this very key ground, Moat Cailin. Uh-huh. Or Moat Cailin, sorry. Uh-huh. I don't know what significance that's going to play, but at the end of the scene, Roose is telling Ramsay to take a force and go up there. Take it for the family.
It's currently held by the Greyjoys, the Ironborn.
Yeah.
And it's preventing, it kind of cuts off, the bulk of the Bolton forces are south of that location, still in the Riverlands. And mm-hmm. it's kind of, you know, a fortification that safeguards the north yeah. along the King's Road.
Okay, it was hard to tell that from the map.
Yeah, he had to smuggle himself past that in his words. So
okay, so the north is the Boltons as long as they can take it.
Right.
And it seems more difficult than it sounds.
It's the same way that Rob was concerned once he was in the campaign in Riverlands and he heard that Winterfell's been sacked. It's like shit. You know, I need Walder Frey to cross and reunite my armies. That's the whole reason the Red Wedding happened. He had to go back with his hat in hand.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on to the next scene is very simple. Varys warns Tyrion about Shay. Found out that his sister knows and that she's going to tell his father. And, you know, Tyrion, I guess, assumed that Varys would be loyal to him. And Varys says, nope, I'm not going to lie to your father for you. That's insane. I've got no one to look after me. I got no one to avenge me.
I agree with him.
I do, too. No one weeps over a spider, as he said. Mm-hmm. I think we can move on to the... I guess brunch before the wedding ceremony, and sees. I guess you call this a Westerosi wedding shower, because everybody's giving Joffrey gifts. Yeah. Mace Tyrell, which is Margaery's father, he's the portly, kind of balding, foppish-looking gentleman,
big blue cloak or big blue, whatever he's wearing, muumuu.
Yeah, he looks like Shakespeare after he's eaten a few mini cheeseburgers.
Sure,
I thought he's really casted well. Because he's like, if you remember, Lady Olenna was talking about him last year, and someone's trying to give him credit about, like, well, he ended the siege of laid siege to Storm's Inn, and she's like, laid siege to the banquet table, more like.
Yeah.
But he gives him a giant cup, and the book of details that this has got, you know, seven sides for the seven gods and the seven kings of Westeros, and it's got all the family houses emblazoned, and it's really elegantly.
I just saw the Lannister one.
Yeah, this one's just, you know, it's all there, but it's not something they belabor to point out to you. But I could I saw the Arryn family seal, among others. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sure it had to have the direwolf, but anyway, we see that Cersei's informing Tywin. We see Shay going about her duties, and she's like, yep, that's the whore, the dark-haired one right there. He wants him brought to his chambers before the wedding, to the Hand's Tower. Tyrion gives Joffrey the Lives of Four Kings, which is, again, they didn't go into great detail, but in the book they mentioned that this is kind of like the equivalent of a Gutenberg Bible, that it's written by this famous maester, and it's illuminated, and there's only like three copies in the entire kingdom that have this particular version and this a condition. And as he says, it should be required reading for every king. And Joff surprisingly accepts it gratefully.
After a stern look from his father, or from his grandfather, rather.
Yeah.
It takes a little Tywin persuasion.
Apparently, the Tywin used every ounce of his public persuasion. Because that's the last bit of discretion we see him show.
Yeah.
Because then his grandfather gives him his gifts, which is the shorter counterpart to Jaime's sword that he got last... of course, as the Hound points out, cunts are wont to name their blades.
Okay.
He names it Widow's Wail and proceeds to just hack to pieces that extremely expensive, priceless book that Tyrion just gave him.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. And then it's like you can already see some danger signs when he's like, yep, every time I use it, it'll be like cutting off Ned's head again, right there in front of Sansa and Tyrion. Next scene.
What do you think of the name? Widow's Wail. How does that strike you?
It's Joffrey's such a poser.
Sure.
I mean, he's had the fucking lion's claw, lion's tooth, heart eater, and now Widow's Wail.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, the only blood he shed is a whore that he had someone chained to his bedpost for target practice.
Mm-hmm.
He is a bully and a coward, and that seems like the type of sword that a bully and coward would name.
Okay.
What do you think?
If You're right. You're right. He's a total coward and bully. If it were in someone else's hands, I like the name Widow's Wail.
Widow's Wail
has a bit of a ring to it.
Yeah, and it's I'm a sucker for alliteration, so Widow's Wail, I got to give him to it for that. Next scene is probably effective depending on how much you buy the Tyrion and Shay relationship and how much you like Shay, but it's Tyrion's rejection of her, and he just really lays on the whore stuff thick. You're a common whore. Yep. You're not fit to be my consort, let alone to bear my children. Sansa, my wife, is fit. You know, I've enjoyed you, but now you've got to go. Shay is devastated. Bronn steps in to take her away. She gets slapped for her trouble, and then end scene. What do you want to talk about this?
I don't know. I know you're not a huge Shay fan.
I think she's a terrible actress, and I in theory, like the deepening that they did with her character versus the Shay in the books.
Okay,
but in practice, I just can't get past the actress's portrayal of such. She's very Marina Sirtis-y.
Oh God.
And all the connotations of that. Do you think so?
I think she's much better looking, yeah.
I don't think
it's the hair, man. I can't get past that 90s hair. Late 80s, early 90s hair.
Fair point. I'm just saying that I don't, a lot of people say that she is very attractive, and I mean, I'm not saying she's a dog by any means, but you know, yeah. I think Roz had the same problem, that she was not maybe the world's greatest actress, but she was warm to the touch. I just don't find anything about Shay to be attractive. Her attitude, her accent, her loyalty to Tyrion somewhat endearing, but Sansa, yeah. But other than that,
I think her heart in a lot of ways is fairly endearing to me. She's not afraid to stand up for her passion.
She is feisty too.
Yeah, and I'm attracted to that, but I think the more I listen to you say that she's not a good actress, and the more I watch these scenes, I'm kind of leaning that way, and I think it would have been a much more effective scene if I had really believed the crying at the end or the interactions. I do like how they overlap dialogue.
Go ahead.
That was really good, where she's basically saying she doesn't care about you, and Tyrion's still going on, and she says you don't care about her.
It felt very operatic that way.
It did. That was really good. And this scene is very well done.
It is.
The beginning,
shot, well written.
Where Tyrion's just staring out the window, and the curtain is flapping, and it's just obscuring him in the shot even. Mm-hmm. Like, that felt very, very cool.
And I think that's the other problem. It's like, I shouldn't say that she is terrible.
I don't think she's terrible.
It's just against everyone else.
That's the thing. Like, playing against Peter Dinklage.
Look at Sansa Stark. The actress's name escapes me, but you look at her, a very young, you know, most of the experience she's had has been on the show, portraying breaking down and you know, emotional grief, like last episode, versus Shay, and just like. Again, sometimes less is more. I thought she was just, I don't know, too big, and too broad. She was that would be an acceptable performance on a stage where you're trying to project out 50, 60 feet, but in close up, it just seemed too much to me.
Yeah, and they do linger on it,
I feel like we're lingering on it maybe a bit too much too.
Fair enough.
Any other points on the scene?
No.
All right, let's go. We go right from Tyrion smashing a wine glass to some good old barbecue in a Dragonstone. Apparently, Melisandre's rounded up some infidels, some people that are still keeping to the old gods, and just burned them at the stake, including King's old brother-in-law, the Queen's brother. And the Queen seems crazy as a shithouse hen.
Yeah. Everyone in this scene is crazy.
Except for Davos. Davos is the one guy trying to keep it trill.
Trying, and he's failing miserably. Come on.
He's scoring points with Stannis. Stannis hates this shit.
But he's still letting it happen. Stannis is supposedly the king, the rightful heir to the Iron Throne, and he's letting this bullshit happen.
But what do you... Okay, because someone had a very good point on Facebook about, you know, you saying that you hate magic and you prefer to politics, but their point was, this magic is politics.
Some of it, yeah.
Like, Melisandre is using some of these parlor tricks and prophecies and stuff as a way to purge dissidents.
Sure.
She would have done it with Davos. In fact...
She tried.
In fact, weren't they supposed to be worried about things going on at the wall? It's they're still just hanging around Dragonstone. I'm somewhat intrigued by how we've come back to finally getting around to catch up with them, and they're just still hanging out at Dragonstone.
Yeah, they should have at least sent a portion of their army, probably Davos.
One would think, yeah, to see what's going on.
Yeah. I don't know. It's yes, I agree. This is magic in service of politics, and that's fine. I get it. I just have such contempt for what is happening in this scene that it's hard for me to relax during it.
All right.
And maybe that's what they want. Maybe they want me to be really fucking annoyed that Stannis is letting this happen. And that the guy who's getting burned alive, his family is standing around, excuse me, letting this happen. Mm-hmm. That's crazy to me.
Well, it's also...
And cheering it on. Not even just letting it happen, but agreeing wholeheartedly this guy needs to be burned because he worshipped the old gods.
That's an interesting statement about religious fanaticism, too.
Tell me about it.
You know, Lady Selyse, the queen, is saying, just like you see, it's actress is phenomenal because she does that look when the people light in flames. She's like, just rapturously joy. It's like, I saw their souls.
Yeah.
And man, you can excuse damn near anything if you're purifying people's souls.
It's crazy.
It's frightening.
Absolute lunacy, in my opinion.
So let's go. Then we go to the dinner scene where they're talking about true hunger. Selyse is fearing for her daughter's soul, Shireen. She thinks Lady Melisandre should go up and talk to her. Shireen seems pretty smart about this whole religion thing, and asking some pretty insightful questions. What do you think the purpose of this is?
Counterpoint, please. You know, like we've got everybody on the beach burning people alive saying this is wonderful. You've got to have at least one person saying this sucks. And Davos has stopped saying that. And I think the daughter, it becomes more effective if someone who we typically consider, a child who we typically consider to be less thoughtful and less understanding points this shit out. You know, sometimes it takes the innocence and the naivete of a child to really get to the point of something.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think you said Davos isn't stopped talking. Well, I mean, he's under pain of death not to oppose Melisandre. And I think he's taken it as far as he can go because at one point...
Yeah.
He's like, do you have any idea how many ships and men your brother brought? It's like, more than you. Yeah.
Well, it also says, like, if this little girl doesn't stop speaking out about it, if she talks to Stannis about it, if she starts trying to convince him, what is Melisandre going to do? Is she going to take this little girl and burn her
at the stake?
Will people get on board with that?
That's the thing I was thinking about, because I think Lady Selyse would be fine with that.
But with Stannis, because he's like, you will not... hit her, she's my daughter. Like,
well, I mean, that's
protective of her.
I think that we can look at these little dilemmas as kind of moral barometers for Stannis' soul.
Sure.
Not soul in the religious sense, but just like, is he still, because arguably he's right now Westeros' best shot to pull his head out of his ass, recognize a true danger, and save the realm. And if you know if your only choice is Joffrey and Stannis, even though Stannis is a hard ass, and I think the other thing that, like, this is such a politically radical idea. It's been 700-800 years since the last religion kind of came into Westeros, and it provoked a bloody civil war. And even now, it's like kind of divided south and north, but they've kind of gotten used to it. Like, okay, well, you got your seven, we've got the old gods. Whatever.
Yeah.
But this would be the equivalent of like a modern day president running as a openly serving, openly devout Muslim.
Okay.
And I don't want to start any like racial or religious bullshit.
Fly.
I'm just making the equivalent of like him embracing this Lord of the Light religion, this foreign religion.
Yeah.
Would and recanting from the seven is that kind of like shocking thing that would be very hard for him to win the support of the entire kingdom.
Yeah, definitely. So even if he takes the throne at this point, you think if he still has his beliefs that Melisandre has instilled in him, the people may not like that?
Well, I mean, might makes right a lot. You know, no one is really great. No one is really super happy with the Targaryens coming in, but they had three giant ass dragons, and there you go. they weren't happy with their polygamy. They weren't happy with their sister fucking. but they weren't of the faith originally either. But so there's a certain amount of that might makes right. I honestly have no idea. What would happen if he would be the eventual winner.
Yeah.
So it'd probably be decades of religious and civil war resulting from it. Okay. All right. Let's go north of the wall. We see Bran warging in the summer, about to sink his teeth into some juicy dough, and then the Reeds and Hodor pull him out of his warging. Say, hey, it's dangerous to spend so much time in wolfskin, because apparently you can lose your humanity.
So much exposition in this scene, my God!
Well,
let's just tell you exactly how everything works here, which is fine. I'm okay for when magic. See,
trying to pin down the magic rules.
Fucking bullshit! When you introduce magic, you've got to explain everything in these extremely long scenes of exposition. That's
it's
all
not
this
extremely
scene was.
Long.
No, it wasn't extremely long, but he had to tell us. Oh, well, don't stay in there too long because you could turn into a wolf or not be able to get out and lose yourself. And then this goes into the tree scene, and
I imagine throwing a hand grenade into the studio asking you what you thought of the warging into the tree business.
Oh, Jesus. I thought dragon flying over King's Landing was cool. How about that?
Yeah. So do you think that is a glimpse of the past or a vision of the future? And... also, one thing I thought was interesting was the vision of the throne room with snow or perhaps ash falling in it. Very similar to the vision that Dany had going through her warlock temple. What do you make of that?
Which one? You Either. Just threw up two. Okay. The snow in the throne room, I assumed was just a sign of things to come because winter is coming. And there's a vacant throne.
Speaking of winter's coming, winter done pulled out and then came back for round two.
Here
in
the Midwest.
And blew all over the Midwest belly. I can't believe it's this deep. And it's fucking April 15th, and I woke up with snow on the ground today.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So I think that's just a sign of bad things to come for the Iron Throne. In general, when winter gets here. And as far as the dragons flying over King's Landing, I don't really know all the history of this universe. So to me, all of this was the future, except for obviously the Ned Stark stuff at the beginning of it. He's dead, as we know. So I felt like this is prophetic of the winter coming and Daenerys coming. Mm.
See, I guess that's the key, because we do see some past events happen.
Yeah.
And we know that dragons were a big part of Westerosi history. You know, 300 years ago, they came over and conquered the whole thing, unified the kingdoms. 100 years ago, they died out. So it's kind of up for grabs.
It's true, yeah.
And I think that's about it. The one thing is that there was a communication from some intelligence that he needs to look for me beneath the tree.
North.
Which
then he says, I know where we need to go.
Which is a really shitty haiku, honestly. I think they could have done better.
Yeah, I mean, that last one syllable
They had the nature imagery, but it's like the last stand. It's not even trying. I have to give him a fail on that.
Can I just say, Bran is getting fucking huge. How much time has passed between the beginning of the series and now? In story terms.
Like 2 years at best.
Oh, Christ. Is Hodor even going to be able to carry him?
Well, I guess that's already a problem because the guy that plays Hodor injured his back
in
the location. And it looked to me like he was using some form of harness because it was, if you look at him carrying him, it's kind of an unnatural gait. Some Andre the Giant prince. Well, because you've not seen The Princess Bride.
I know who Andre the Giant is, yeah.
Yeah, but there's some of that because Andre, even though he's massive, his back was just terrible at that time. He could not lift Robin Wright.
Yeah.
So they had to do this elaborate harness that supported her weight. And I kind of got that flavor from from that scene. It's a problem.
Yeah, he looked like about maybe 10 when they started. He looks like he's about 14 now. So which would make sense.
And honestly, if you see him outside of his makeup, they do a pretty damn good job making him look as young as he does.
Wow.
Because I was watching him on some of the DVD interviews or the Blu-ray interviews, and I think they're doing a really good job. Sophie Turner, who plays Sansa, is actually a very tall woman. She's like 5'10".
Oh, wow.
Supposedly, Bran is now the tallest of the Stark children.
Holy cow.
So, yeah, they're...
You got a 6-foot dude portraying a 10-year-old?
Well, I mean, that puberty is a hell of a thing.
I guess so.
So,
the ravages of time.
Right. Let me see.
Mostly just ravaging Hodor's back, though.
The ravages of Lumbar. House Lumbar. Our backs hurt.
House back brace.
Our house words are, God damn my back. Anyway, back to King's Landing. We're in the middle of a goddamn wedding. And speaking of goddamn, Marjorie, goddamn.
Looking good, Marjorie.
Looking good. She's working it. The High Septon intones, cursed be he who would seek to tear them asunder. And the camera focuses on Oberyn, Olenna, Loras, and Pycelle. Those are the characters we're actually familiar with that the camera is focusing on as these words are spoken. You make anything of that, Jim?
What were the words that were spoken there?
Just the standard, you know, curse any man who is, you know, what the gods have put together, let no man break.
Okay. Huh. It's an interesting clue as far as kind of the mystery that we see at the end of this episode. And I guess it's supposed to be a mystery, right? I mean, is that what they're going for? Like, they expect everybody to be talking about who killed
certainly
Joffrey.
I will say, okay. I will say a couple things. You can piece together 90% of the whodunit just based on visual evidence in this episode.
Okay.
And I've got some discussions of people that claim not to be book readers who are digging into these issues. And I'm going to save that at the very end of the feedback section because...
Well, if you're going to say that these people... You're basically saying these people are right.
No, I'm
saying... You've got to put that in the spoiler section.
I'm saying that the evidence is all there and there's a lot of...
I know. By saying
three or four different theories about what the evidence means. But I'm saying just pointing out the pieces of evidence... It's
I don't
weird.
Think that's a spoiler.
Yeah, well, because like on Breaking Bad, I know. I'm just trying to be sensitive. With Breaking Bad, when there is a time where, oh God, I'm trying to be sensitive.
No,
spoilers.
Don't spoil
know,
that.
I'm
yeah.
not.
Okay.
But there's a time where some character has a theory that planted something on another character. And the evidence was visually there on the screen, but we didn't find out till like a season and a half later that in fact did happen.
Yeah.
But you could talk about the theory and maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, or maybe it was just this, or maybe it's just that. No one really knew. Well, here we have the answers.
In the books. Yeah.
And they've been very clever about putting all the evidence out there that would support that conclusion. But I don't think you can get the whole story just from looking at the episode because there's a couple things you just have to wait on. I just want to give everybody a heads up that we will be talking about that, but it's going to be the last thing we talk about. And if you are sensitive about, if you just want to feel clever and try to figure this out on your own, you can shut it off before then.
All right. And I have not read that feedback or the books or anything.
Right.
So my speculation here is my own speculation.
Yep.
I think that's interesting that they would show, I guess, these characters, right before, like saying, you know, breaking apart a marriage, this particular marriage, and then Joffrey dies at the end. I wonder if that's not a clue, like trying to say that Olenna and her cohorts did it. I don't know. I feel like there's also some Oberyn-y stuff in there as well.
Sure.
So, and I definitely don't think it was Tyrion, but we'll get there, right?
Yep, we will. Okay. I'm going to...
Although Tyrion in the scene looks disgusted, I think that Joffrey gets his bride that he loves, and Tyrion was just forced to send his away.
Mm.
It seems like he's fairly angry about that.
Sure. So now we see, speaking of Lady Olenna, Tywin and Lady Olenna are talking. I thought it's hilarious how Mace, her son, who's a lord in his own right, walks up and is like, hey, starts opening his mouth. He's like, not now. You know, the adults are talking.
That's her son?
Yeah.
How old is this woman supposed to be? Like 90?
Well, look how old she is. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
But he's come on, Mace isn't like...
He's in his 50s.
All right, sure.
I guess in the time, she'd probably be like 70, maybe.
Man, and if you're a lord in this damn universe, it seems like as soon as your bride is flowered, yeah, quote-unquote flowered, which 13, 14, you're trying to put a baby inside of her. Mm-hmm. So she might be anywhere in her 60s. From her 60s into 70s, right. I don't know how old Dame Diana Riggs is. I could probably find out on Wikipedia. Maybe if you get on a tear, I'll do that.
Okay.
But it doesn't really matter. She's basically taunting Tywin about how indebted they are to her and how she's like basically worrying about the Iron Bank. You know, wars are so expensive. You know, how much gold are you shitting anyway?
Yeah, and she seems to think it's an issue, whereas Tywin doesn't.
Well, I mean, if Tywin was a word about it, you think he'd sweat in front of...
No, of course not.
I will say that this feast looks annoying as hell. It's basically just a bunch of street buskers coming up and assaulting, like juggling you, aggressive, light in your face, and blowing fire. And I was like, can I just eat my fucking pigeon pie?
Yeah.
How much do I got to pay to sit at a table where no one juggles in my fucking face? That's me as extroverted as I get eating out is like a Japanese steakhouse.
Yeah.
And I still hate it when I have to share the table with people I don't know.
Oh, like a hibachi grill?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like that's the worst when you go with a party of four and there's another party.
Yeah.
And they're a bunch of fuckwits and like, you know, it's like you're catching food and it gets to them like, oh, we don't catch food. I'm like, oh, I feel like a jackass now. I caught food like a fucking seal for your amusement. And you won't? Fuck you, buddy. See?
Yeah, yeah. I'm
poorly socialized.
The busker is the correct term because they expect tips.
The people
as well.
Are throwing coins at you. Yeah. I would definitely have a bunch of gold drags in my pocket just to bean them. Move it. Beat it. Here's one right between your eyes, fucker.
Yep.
All right. Bronn assures Tyrion that he's shipped because the rest of this thing is just one big scene.
Yeah.
Bronn assures Tyrion that Shay has been shipped off to Pentos.
Okay, I have no idea where that is, but I know it takes a boat to get there.
Pentos is the first location, one of the first locations we see. It's where Dany and her brother, who I've completely blanked on, Viserys, start their journey at.
Okay.
That's where Khal Drogo rides up, is like, yep, fuckable, and then takes off. That's Pentos. That's basically what he did.
No, you're absolutely right, yeah.
I thought it was funny. Oberon says hello, and Tyrion said, "Hey, how's it going?" He's like, "No, I'm not talking to you." And it pans to the pretzel bender. Mm-hmm. Lady Olenna comes up and fusses over Sansa's hair, teases Tyrion about him begging last season for, you know, the Tyrells help paying for the wedding. Says if your pauper husband can sell his mule and last pair of shoes, maybe he can afford to come down to Highgarden and visit.
Wow. Yeah, she also apologizes. Or not apologizes, but said she's sorry about what happened
Miserates.
To Robin Catelyn, yeah. So I don't know what her motives are with Sansa. It seems to be that she does actually care about her well-being, based on stuff we saw last season, but... Mm-hmm. I really couldn't tell you at this point. I know everybody seems to have ulterior motives.
Right on. Okay, so we then see a band that's playing like a very dispirited version of The Reigns of Castamere, and Tyrion gets sick of their shit and gives him a golden shower.
Wait, not Tyrion.
Joffrey.
Yeah.
This actually is a band, an Icelandic post-rock band, whatever the hell that is, and their name is, and I'm probably going to butcher this, but it's Sigur Rós, and they're also...
I think it's Sigur Rós.
It's not, and it's... Because I actually looked at... I went on... I know the first is Sigur.
Sigur Rós?
It's not Sigur. There's no
G. I've heard it pronounced all sorts of ways.
Really?
So, yeah.
Well, it's probably because dumb fucks like me are reading it. but I'm not going to go and try to pronounce anything else that I found in a Wikipedia article.
Okay.
But the upshot is the people playing the very excellent haunted version of The Reigns of Castamere at the end over the credits, that is this band.
Yeah.
I actually thought it could be Jack Gleason.
Yeah, I don't know that he could sing that well.
I don't know that he can, but he could.
I don't know that he can't either, yeah.
It sounded kind of like a Jack Gleason. Okay. But anyway, then we have the Queen's announcement that the leftovers at the feast will be given to the poor, which I thought was kind of...
That's her shtick.
An underwhelming... Like, you know, what we you will mean? Slop the pigs with our leftovers after the...
It's better than whatever they were going
to
do with
feeding them. Feeding it to the hounds or throwing it away or whatever. Yeah. But it's still, it's like one of those, like, kind of let them eat cake things.
Sure.
That I'm sure she thought she's being generous, but it seemed like a kind of a dick move.
Yeah, yeah. It's not as bad as let them eat cake.
right. Then Cersei comes up and gives her kiss on both cheeks and says, oh, you're an example to us all.
Mm.
Keep that in mind as we see the first of many showdowns. One is Loras versus Jaime.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Before this happens, there's a knowing nod between Oberyn and Loras.
Oh, yeah. Oh, like knowing in the biblical sense.
Yes. Yeah. Like, I don't know if they have already hooked up. But it seems like at some point they're going to.
There was an open invitation
to
either begin the union or rekindle it.
Sure. So I thought that was interesting. What did I think about the confrontation between Loras and Jaime?
Mm-hmm.
I thought Loras got the better of him, like I said in the instant cast. And we kind of covered this.
Yeah, because it's something Jaime wants and Loras doesn't.
So yeah.
Anytime you're going off of that, you're playing with a pretty poor hand.
For sure.
No pun intended. You're playing with a gilded steel hand, not a solid gold one.
No, not at all.
Anything else to say about that?
Nope.
Brienne comes up to the royal table, wishes the couple well. Cersei then, after making amusement at the fact that she bows instead of curtsies, says she owes her gratitude. Fascinating scene. Brienne says, Jaime rescued me more than once.
Mm-hmm.
Rescued me hard. Rescued me all night long.
Jesus.
Cersei then bitches to her, well, it must be nice to flit from one camp to the next and just, you know, be loyal to whoever suits you. And then she drops the you love him bomb, and we cut to a long scene of Brienne saying shit, and then a long scene of Cersei going shit, and then a glance across to Jaime seeing them both look at each other saying shit. What do you make of this? We talked about this instant cast.
Yeah. And I've really looked at it the second time I watched it.
What's there?
My opinion did not change. I think Brienne didn't realize that she had actual feelings for Jaime until Cersei brought it up. Cersei's realizing this might be a problem in the future. Although I don't think Cersei is back on the Jaime bandwagon yet, right? She's still kind of doing her...
That doesn't mean she wants anybody else to
be... You waited too long thing.
That doesn't mean she wants anybody else to be on that... quote-unquote bandwagon.
That's true. It's harder for me to tell what's going through Cersei's head here. Maybe you have some speculation on that, but as far as Brienne goes, I think she's waking up to the notion that she does.
Yeah, there was a really good take on Facebook, and I'm trying to find out real quick who had the thought, but it's kind of echoing you that maybe Brienne didn't even realize...
Mm-hmm.
No, it's actually Nina Perez from the Project Fandom. She said it was shock that Cersei would ask that, and then her immediate internal response was a yes, which also shocked her.
Yeah.
It's like, oh shit, I might love this man.
Yeah, her eyes widened. You can tell what she's thinking.
You know, what I think is really telling about this, because this has been a debate, you know, that I've been aware of for a while amongst book readers about how does Jaime feel about Brienne? How does Brienne feel about Jaime? Is it, is it, you know, platonic? Is it brother, sister? Is it fellow warrior? There's definitely ambiguity here. And the guy that wrote this fucking episode is George R.R. Martin himself.
Yeah.
So anyone saying there's no ambiguity here can go fuck themselves. Because if this was his golden opportunity to put that down and end that ambiguity...
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that they're going to get together and they're going to have kids and going to be happy ever after. I'm just saying it's very complicated. And that's certainly what I got from reading the books, and I think that's vindicated in the scene.
And it feels like it's just going to get more complicated because there could be a potential love triangle developing here between Cersei, Jaime, and Brienne. That's a very bad thing for Brienne, in my opinion, because she doesn't have any of the power. Cersei, can we talk about this? Who the fuck is the queen now?
Okay.
Because
let's leave that because there's a lot of feedback about that question.
Okay. Okay, good.
So we got that. Cersei then goes up, cock blocks Pycelle right into the glass. tells him to quit your lechin' and go down to the kitchens and tell them to feed all the leftovers to the dogs. He's like, but the queen. And she's like, I'm the queen.
Yeah.
And interestingly, so Pycelle waddles off, but in the very next scene, he's seen sitting close to Varys still at the feast.
Hmm.
So did he put on his track shoes quit the old man act, ran down to the kitchens and come back? Or did he's like, well, fuck the old queen. New queen said this. And I'm more afraid.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a hard piece of math to do if you're Pycelle, because you're a Lannister creature.
Yeah.
Joffrey's a vicious cunt. Cersei's a vicious creature.
You won't call Cersei a vicious cunt?
No.
Even though you call Joffrey one?
Yeah, because I have a hard time calling women that.
That's sexist.
I don't care. I'll be sexist about that.
All right.
Jack Gleeson gives very good cunt. Everyone says he's a charming dude in real life, though. He was very...
I'm sure he is, yeah.
Natalie Dormer, who plays Marjorie, do a co-commentary on one of the Season 3 Blu-rays.
Cool.
Hilarious. He's very funny and self-aware about Joffrey and...
That's good.
All that.
Yeah, I find it pretty easy to separate his character from the actor
there,
because he's just such an asshole.
Yeah.
I don't believe that anyone could be that way in real life and get to where he is.
And such... I mean, it's very hard to play a hateable character that's not just... You just... There's hateable characters like him, and there's hateable characters that are just annoying unintentionally, or the writers don't have a good grasp on, you know, what is irritating versus what is hateable.
Okay,
And he does a very good job.
It's
both.
Like watching a Rob Schneider movie.
Right.
Versus watching Jack
Gleeson.
You're not
supposed to hate him.
Yeah, but I do.
And we're supposed to hate this, but also, like, you know, a lot of people express sorrow that he's gone because he's such a great character.
Yeah.
He's like one of those guys you love to hate, and we don't got Joffrey to kick around no more.
Yep.
Anyway, I forget what we're going to... Oh, yeah, Ser Dantas shows up, gets pelted with whatever is at hand to be thrown, exit stage left. Oberon and Ilaria then square off versus Tywin and Cersei. And I thought that Ilaria was like, on my instant take, was kind of put off by the conversation, or at least she was shut up. But I actually think she was so impressed by her man. Like, when I ever cut to her, she was just like excited, like, oh, Oberon's kicking their ass.
Huh.
I don't think she jumped in, not because she didn't feel like he needed any backup.
Mm, yeah.
We both thought that Oberon won this fairly handily. Do you have any other thoughts on multiple watches?
No, this was a fairly straightforward scene, I thought.
Yeah, basically, you're the former queen regent, not even the real queen.
Sure.
You're a broke ass old man that should have gout, and I got your daughter and your granddaughter as a hostage, and I'm not going to rape
and I've got the moral high ground.
And I got the moral high ground.
So what do you got?
That's right. So it was pretty much a decisive victory.
Mm-hmm.
Joffrey calls an end to the amusement with his War of the Five Kings farce. Who is Renly supposed to be riding?
I don't know, but he's got his ass out.
If that's supposed to be Ser Loras, that is ballsy even for Joffrey.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's some dude in a, like, a white... It's got to be a dude, or else none of the jokes make sense.
Well, Stannis is riding Melisandre. Yeah.
Greyjoy's riding a squid.
Rob has the wolf head on.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just assume that it's is Loras.
I think you're right, and that's...
That's, like, a huge fuck you to the Tyrells, man, which explains all their
dour expressions.
I mean,
he does fuck yous to his own house. I mean, look at what he does to Tyrion in this episode.
But no, like, I mean, I don't think his grandfather... Well, no, I don't think Tywin likes public mocking of any Lannister.
I don't think so, no.
I mean, as he said, he went to war when Tyrion got captured. So even the least of his children, he's pretty fucking serious about their honor.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. Tywin's got to be just stewing here.
Oh, well, that's the thing. You look at his
face,
and it is like he's having an internal conniption fit that he can't let on, because what is he going to do? Emasculate the... It's one thing to do that in a small council.
Yeah.
But in all the public, Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of disbelief that, like, oh my God, he's really behaving. Let's just get to it. So,
okay.
Did you notice Varys getting bopped in the head by Renly's mace?
No, I didn't see it.
There's a scene right like at the 44-minute mark where, you know, Renly's kind of gone into the quote-unquote Renly's gone into the crowd, and he rides past Varys and smacks his head with his fake mace, and Varys just, like, closes his eyes like Sideshow Bob. Like, ugh.
Yeah.
He just can't stand being around all these idiots. And then we get to the humiliation of Tyrion. It's already humiliating enough.
Yes.
Your uncle's a dwarf. You hire a bunch of humiliating dwarf entertainment. Mm-hmm. And you're taking shots at his wife's brother, reminding everyone that she's got traitor's blood. Although I will say that I quite enjoyed the wildfire explosion of confetti that came out of the Stannis.
I was wondering what that was. I couldn't tell. Okay.
I wondered what it was too, but then when I watched the second time, I heard the Stannis guy go, "Oh no, wildfire!"
That's pretty funny.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah,
but and Tyrion tries to handle it gracefully, like he's trying to give, but he can't resist, you know, putting a barb. Yeah. And then what I thought was interesting about Joff's stupidity is that, you know, he keeps insulting Tyrion, and Tyrion tries to turn around. He's like, "Well, you're the king." This is, and he's like, "It's not intended to be an honor," you know. And just the fact that he's completely lacking of self awareness, and also, and this is why I think Jack Gleeson's brilliant. He plays this like when he's ordering Tyrion to kneel. He plays like he's got this awareness of the room, because when Tyrion doesn't do it, he kind of looks around like, "Oh God, I'm being embarrassed," but he completely lacks empathy. The fact that everyone is so fucking uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that is a very hard thing to communicate. I've seen lots of actors and actresses do that whole self-conscious thing. Mm-hmm. And it looked kind of, and it just, you know, there's a difference between a good actor and a bad actor, I guess.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think he's a great actor.
So it gets really fucking awkward with his cupbearer stuff. He pours a glass of wine on Jeffrey. It's just wine.
Well, no, on Tyrion.
On Tyrion. It's just wine.
Yep.
He knocks the glass over. Tyrion has to crawl under the table. Sansa helps him out. Orders him to kneel. It's just super tense. And then Marjorie breaks the tension with, "Look, the pie."
She does that a couple times in this episode.
She tries really hard.
Yeah.
Really hard.
Yeah, she does.
Joffrey then takes his Valyrian steel sword, slices open the pie. A bunch of birds shoot out of it, like in the nursery song.
Bunch of birds stay in it.
I like the cut to the devastation he's wrought to, like, half the pigeon population in there.
Yeah, I like how it shocks him. It surprises him. He falls backwards and holds onto his crown and bobbles his sword.
He's like, "Oh!"
And then tries to play it off like, "I knew that was going to happen."
Right. No,
just a small touch that...
He's a giant dick.
Yeah.
And he's just such a coward. So anyway, at this point, Tyrion tries to leave. You know, and Joffrey calls on, he's like, "No, where are you going, cupbearer? This pie is dry. I need some wine." And then he starts choking. People start losing their shit. Jaime's the first that comes running. At this, Ser Dantas comes up and delivers a pizza to Sansa. Wait, no, that's Ser Donatus. He actually comes up and says, "You gotta, you know," he Schwarzeneggers to her, "Come with me if you want to live." Apparently they fuck off somewhere, and Joffrey manages to finger Tyrion, you know, point at him as he dies gruesomely. Really great effects work. Cersei says, you know, sees him off with his head, and we cut the Seer Rose singing the Lannisters theme song.
Yeah, what a great way to end this episode. Completely unexpected, but great. Just great all around. I loved it.
So anything else to put, or should I just slide around into the paying the bills portion of this podcast?
Well, I have a lot of questions. I have questions, all right, which I know we'll talk about the queen stuff here in a bit.
Let me pay the bills, and then we'll get your questions, and then we'll get to feedback.
Okay.
So you're listening to this podcast is on the Bald Move Network. It's Jim and I and a bunch of other podcasters, and we're almost 100% funded by the generosity of our listeners. There's a couple ways you can support us. One is using our Amazon affiliate link at amazon.baldmove.com. If you're shopping on Amazon, please, please, please use our link. And it doesn't have to be big money, because there's a couple ways Amazon rewards us. One is sheer dollar amount, but also the number of items that are ordered in any one given month increases. Like, we hit thresholds. Like, when we refer 400 items, we get X amount of percent, and it gets up and up. So, you know, if just even ordering a toothbrush or toenail clippers, that still counts towards that and gets us more money. So appreciate everyone that does that. Also, check out our Subbable.com/baldmove. Subbable is a voluntary subscription system where you can sign up and agree to send us on a single one-time basis or monthly recurring a dollar, a couple dollars. And the cool thing is, it's, you know, Jim's called it like Kickstarter on layaway, because you can take the money that you've sent to us and bank it towards rewards. So, you know, if you send us a dollar a month, after 10 months, you can qualify for one of the $10 rewards. So check it out. Well, look at our pitch on there. If nothing else, please rate and review us on iTunes. That's the primary way we get new listeners. So if you've got no money and no Amazon, you can do that. Or tell a friend. Any way that we can grow the network is a way that you can support us, and we really appreciate that. You know, it's not just us doing television. We also have got the three ladies out in L.A., Amy, Gerald, and Susan, doing the Because Show, talking about women's issues, sexuality, book reviews, pop culture, culinary arts. You got the two jackasses in Seattle, Eric and Jesse, talking about beer, board games, comic book movies, any kind of general geek stuff. They're awesome. They're hilarious. And don't forget about Tom and Kelly. They're doing Mr. Selfridge right now, which is on Masterpiece Theater. They handle all things Britannia for us. Also very funny, very clever people. And that's all. I've got the bills paid. Jim, what questions do you have?
Okay, a couple of questions. Can we talk about the queen now? Who the fuck is the queen at this point? Because there are a couple things in the episode that suggests that Cersei is not queen, and yet when she commands that,
all right, let's read,
Tyrion be taken away.
Let's read an email. Van T says, I wonder if you guys could talk about the power struggle between the former queen regent Cersei and the new queen Margaery. During the wedding, Margaery declared all the leftover food to go to the poorest people in the city. However, moments later, Cersei tells Pycelle to let the leftovers go to the dogs. Pycelle finds himself in an awkward position, whether to follow the commands of his queen or disobey her out of fear of Cersei. Which do you think he would have done, and will Margaery be able to maintain the throne and power now that Joffrey's dead?
Okay, I mean, that's a little bit of a different question, right?
But it comes to the heart of it is who's in charge.
It does. So Margaery has not consummated and will never consummate this marriage.
And I think that's Joffrey. The key.
Okay, that's what I've seen from several people. The fact that it's not consummated means that she's not actually the queen, and that potentially Cersei could end up being the queen once again until they get a replacement for Joffrey. My other question
is... They have a replacement for Joffrey. His name's Tommen, and if people didn't notice...
Is it the blonde kid sitting next to Tyrion?
Yep.
Okay, exactly. That was my other question. Who's going to be the king now?
The next Lannister bastard of a incestual union of Jaime and Cersei in line for the throne is Tommen. He's younger. Oh, he's younger than... That's the only thing we know, is that he's visibly younger than Joffrey.
And that he laughs at the stuff that Joffrey does this episode.
Uncomfortably, though. He at least feels guilty when he notices his
only because he's sitting next to Tyrion, yeah. Mm-hmm. He laughs, and then he looks over and, oh, maybe I shouldn't have laughed at that.
Sure, sure.
So I guess Joffrey wouldn't have cared.
Right, Joffrey just kept laughing, or would have laughed harder when he saw his making Tyrion uncomfortable. I believe Tommen was the only child that showed excitement at Tyrion coming back in the second season.
Oh, okay.
If you go all the way back to Joff's named it day celebration.
Huh.
So that's my intake, and, you know, it's an open question about, you know, what's going to happen. Is Margaery, I mean, this is now the second king that she's not had sex with after being married to. is that going to be a taint? Is Tommen old enough to marry her?
I don't know what her status is.
What will the Tyrells say? Because, you know, this has been, you know, they're expecting to be married into the royal family, and it, now it's up in air. Are there, they just paid for this lavish wedding. What the hell's going on there? You have any other questions that come to mind?
I don't know. It seems like you're not going to definitively answer who is the queen, because we're not supposed to know yet. I don't know. My big question is the ceremony the important thing? Because that happened. Or is the consummation the important thing? Seems like in this world, the consummation is part of the ceremony. They go together, or there is no marriage.
Well, I think in the old world, and still this day, for, like, I think Roman Catholics, or at least devout ones, it's important, the whole consummation. That
important, or the thing, like, that the determines thing, whether, like, or not you're married?
Sex between married couples is a sacrament that is part of the marriage ceremony. So it's like not saying I do. Now, in our world, it doesn't matter. Did you sign the fucking marriage license?
Exactly, yeah.
Boom, you're married. It doesn't matter whether a, you know, dog catcher married you or the Pope. It's all legal in our secular society.
Yeah.
But in this society where the high priest is over, I'm sure there's games that you can play. It's an open question about whether, I mean, Marjorie really didn't consummate, because she tried really hard to get Renly to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Who's to say they didn't get it a few times? I mean, I don't know. She told obvious pack of lies to Joffrey last season, but I think consummation is as important. It's basically the last checkbox, which is why the bedding ceremony is so important.
Yeah.
It's a way for publicly everyone to certify that these people have boned in the story.
Then I'm worried that Cersei may become Queen Regent again.
I would say Cersei, it's, even if it was all the I's dotted and T's crossed, if Joffrey died, I can't imagine her, you know, just giving up the regency that easily.
I'm sure she would try. Her power isn't gone, even if she's not the queen, certainly.
Well, that is, I don't know. I don't know that that's true.
I mean, she has far more sway with her family and with people in the kingdom than does Marjorie.
That's true, but her power diminished appreciably when Tywin came back to the scene.
True, yeah.
She definitely still has power and pull, and she's still a Lannister, but
I'm sure there are people screaming, this is exactly how it goes, and why don't you people know this?
Well, I do.
Right now.
I'm just saying.
I know you do, but you don't want to give away book knowledge.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's start the feedback proper. We asked what the purple wedding meant, because I honestly was ignorant of the terminology. And we've got a couple spoiler answers and a couple non-spoiler answers. And I'll give the spoiler, non-spoilery ones now. Xavier said the purple wedding is another way of saying a royal wedding. Purple is the color of royalty since going back to antiquity.
Yep.
Word has it the Emperor Nero once made it illegal for anyone in Rome to wear purple but him. What a diva, that Nero. Jeffrey B. says, as Joffrey lay down to die, the first person to his side is not Cersei, not Marjorie, not Tywin. Rather, it is Jaime. I can only see this as Jaime recognizing that his son was dying, not his son, the king, but his son. Yet when Cersei, Jaime's former lover and mother to Joffrey, arrives, she pushes poor Jaime aside and yells, "Don't touch him!" Made me feel for Jaime, and just goes to show how far he has fallen, that he has to hover over off to the side like a decoration as his own son dies.
Should have smacked her with that golden hand.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh, sorry. Gilded steel hand.
Who would have thunk that Khal Drogo's wedding would turn out to be the most dull of all weddings in the show? damn fine
with
point.
The killings and the nudity.
I don't know that Jaime knows what to feel. I mean, he feels at a gut level about this, but an open question about how he really feels about Joffrey.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
I mean, it's his flesh and blood, but he's not been a father to him his entire life in the way that Cersei's been his mother.
Yeah.
Janine S. said, I'm pretty sure that Melisandre was sizing up Shireen. After all, King's blood can do magic, and how much more pure do you get than Shireen? The only reason she doesn't just kill her is that Stannis loves his daughter, even though he has no way to show it comfortably, and that he will kill Melisandre with the help of Ser Davos if she harms her. Mm-hmm. If the girl, quote-unquote, believes in the Red God, there might be another angle, but Shireen is smarter than that, and doesn't think she believes in much anymore. I really like the glimpses of her character we've gotten in the series. She's much more than she is in the books thus far. Do you give two shits to comment on that, Jim, or should we keep going?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's interesting.
The concept of Selyse and Melisandre perhaps scheming to either co-opt and corrupt her or sacrifice her is interesting and horrifying, I think.
Sure.
Joss H. says, why do we regard Jaime as such a great swordsman? They mentioned what a great tourney rider he was, but swordsman? Was a sword hand famous simply because it killed Aerys?
I think the mythos has built him up to be a great swordsman. I seem to recall, I mean, I've never read the books, and I don't talk to people about Game of Thrones, so the fact that I think he's a great swordsman tells me that there's something in the show that says that he's a great swordsman.
Well, I mean, that's the thing.
And he himself, I mean, Brienne is kind of worried when he gets that sword on the bridge, right?
Even though he's weak,
and tied up hands, and
chained.
Yeah.
So the problem with the works of Martin is a lot of the problem of the show is that most of the action is described that is very rarely shown. So we have, you know, some canonical badasses like Sir Arthur Dayne and Sir Barristan Selmy, who we know, we see, I mean, I've seen enough of Sir Barristan to know that he, especially in his prime, was a ferocious sword fighter. And Jaime was said to be his equal.
And
he was not even remotely afraid of Ned Stark. I mean, he's really not. I mean, I've never seen him be afraid of anybody before losing his hand. And like you said, I know also I've seen enough of Brienne to know that she is a good swordswoman. And he, I think in the book, actually did a slightly better job of taking her to the limit. You know, with one hand tied behind his back and in a weakened condition than they showed in, because they don't have time to spend like 15 pages describing a sword fight that rages all over the place. Where in the book, it's like, you know, we got 30, it's something that they knew that George Lucas doesn't, that people can only watch a sword fight for so long before you start getting bored with it.
Sure.
So that's that again, it's not something we ever see. It's just kind of word of mouth. Van T says, we already talked about that. Bradley H says, I'm trying to figure out what led to deterioration of the relationship between Cersei and Pycelle. Early in the series, the two seemed to work together frequently. She even worked to free Pycelle after Tyrion jailed him, and now she can't stand him. Am I forgetting something that happened? Jim?
I don't know. That's a really good question, because I'm in the same boat he is.
I think we're seeing the deterioration of his status.
Wow, it deteriorated fast. Like his health. Like his apparent health.
Well, I mean, fact is, Cersei's becoming a drunk.
Yeah.
She's something of a mean drunk. Her brother, you know, she expected Pycelle to be kind of her woman, and her brother ended around and had him thrown in jail on pretenses of him being, you know, a lecher and a traitor and all that stuff. And she also probably has had a baseline kind of level of disgust. And, you know, like she alluded to last episode, that he's probably tried to get her naked and, oh, I need to examine you. Oh, you know, to give you a thorough examination. So she's just not above bullying and threatening an old man to get her way. I don't think that we have seen any cause for, you know, he's done nothing but try to serve the Lannisters to this point. So. Chris A says, did Marjorie set the new exit strategy for awkward situations? Look, the pie, then walks away. I think we should make that a thing, Jim. Anytime things are getting a little awkward on a podcast, just say, look, the pie, and move on.
Okay, we can make that a thing.
We should make a t-shirt. Just have a pie in the front, and then look, you know. Pimby, you guys alluded to the verbal sparring, the fact that the Lannisters seem to lose all of their spars this week. I like how these reflect the political situation the Lannister's characters find themselves in. Tywin lost his battle with Oberyn. This mirrors the fact that he almost broke from his This mirrors the fact that he is almost broke from his wars and is about to lose grip on the throne. He also lost to the Queen of Thorns, in my view. Cersei lost with Tywin against Oberyn, foreshadowing the loss of her son and already her daughter and her love and her liver. Jaime lost to Loras, reflecting the loss of his hand, his father, based on last week, his love and soon-to-be loss of his son. You could also throw in respect there, giving his tutelage by Bronn. Joffrey lost to Tyrion in that, although Tyrion was humiliated, he never did get Tyrion to kneel before him, Zod style. I can't decide if Shae being sent away is a win for Tyrion in that she is alive or a loss in that she is gone. Either way, I think she will be dead soon. What's your non-spoiler take on that, Jim?
I just agree. I mean, the Lannisters have been beaten up this episode, right?
What do you think about the speculation about Shae's status? Think she's a goner?
I really don't know.
Do you think this show's got the balls to kill Tyrion?
Wow. I think he's everybody's favorite character. That's the trouble.
Do they have the balls to kill Bronn?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they can kill Bronn at any time. I enjoy his performance, but I think he's not that valuable as far as the story goes. Yeah, I don't know. You might... Killing Tyrion would take some serious balls.
Uh-huh.
And I think if anybody's got him, it's George Martin.
What about Dany?
Kill Dany right now?
No, I mean, like...
At any point?
In a Daryl Dixon time frame, in the next season or two.
Oh, God.
I'm just testing to see if you think anyone can die in the show. Because a lot of people say that, but I wonder if they really believe it.
I don't think Daenerys can die yet. It seems like she's got big things in store for her. And if we don't see those play out, I'm going to feel cheated. At least to the point where dragons are strafing cities, blowing people up.
Okay.
That's got to happen. Otherwise, what the hell are we doing?
All right.
As far as Tyrion goes, I feel like his major opponent was defeated this episode, but then you got Cersei, who's kind of become a major opponent at this point.
And wants to pin it all on him.
And does want to pin it all on him. So I could see him dying in the next season, sure. Or even this season, near the end.
Mildly interesting, Jim. Mildly interesting analysis. Ben G says, am I the only one who's let down by Joffrey's death? I was hoping for a Theon-style fate or at least a scene with Joffrey whimpering and begging for his life. He went out pretty quick and did nothing to embarrass himself or his legacy. What do you think, Jim?
I
have a strong take on this.
I thought it was fairly fitting the way he went out. He went out after being humiliated after humiliating someone else. And that was okay with me.
Yeah.
That's what I just wanted to see him. I mean, choking on a pie, which is, it looked to everyone like that's what happened.
Right.
He choked on a pie. I'm sure there are going to be reports of the king died eating pie.
It seems like later that was on. The intent.
Yeah.
If we're going to speculate that this was murder most foul and not just Cersei overreacting.
I'm pretty sure it was murder and not just a
blood
an
doesn't
off,
squirt out your nose and ears when pie. you just choke, really?
No, I don't think so.
But if we're going to go with that theory, then shit, I built this up to where I can't even say. What was I saying?
I don't know, man. You going to ask me what you were saying?
Yeah, you can't see it in the fires or burn a leech and tell me what I was thinking.
Sorry.
God damn it, I hate when I do that. Anyway.
Moving on.
Short of like an Indiana Jones style, open up the ark and your face melts off your skull, I don't see how you can get much better. Yes, you could torture him, you could make him beg for your life, but you know, I don't know that that would bring anything new to the table, and I don't know that thematically feels the same.
Thematically, you're right.
How in the world would that ever happen? He is in absolute security. Like,
he's
it's
going to
be something
power.
Like a... You know, a freaky scorpion, like what tried to kill out Dany, or an assassin's dagger, or a faceless man, or a poison. You're not going to get that long, drawn-out torture, you know.
Yeah, ending. Kidnapping the king and shackling him to a cross in your dungeon is not an option.
Mm-mm.
It's not going to happen. You got the Kingsguard. That's the whole point of the Kingsguard.
So, let's see. Anissa said, a question for both of you that concerns Joffrey's death. I've read online that many people were elated at his death and cheering throughout that scene.
Yeah.
But Germ, George R. R. Martin has said that he wanted the readers' viewers to feel some kind of empathy for Joffrey because, at least in the books, he is still only a 13-year-old boy.
Oh, no, I don't care. He's a 13-year-old asshole.
I am a book reader, and even though I feel that Joffrey deserved the terrible death that he received, the scene in the book, and to some extent the scene in the show of his death, did evoke some sympathy for me for the character.
Really?
I felt like the scene in the book made me stop and think about Joffrey as a person and consider whether or not all of his evilness wasn't completely his fault, and maybe he was a product of his environment. I don't think that came off as well in the show. So what do you think of that? Because I don't agree with her overall thesis that I feel sorry for Joffrey.
Hell no.
But I do have some sympathy for the, well, it wasn't all his fault.
I don't think it's all his fault, but if you look at his family, nobody else is that much of an asshole. His mom,
Cersei?
Yes, his mom is like that, but not nearly to the degree that Joffrey is. Joffrey does it for the sake of his own amusement. I don't think Cersei really did that. Cersei did it because people were working against her. Joffrey just takes a fucking glass of wine, pours it on Tyrion's head, plans in advance to humiliate him with a dwarf show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's put a lot of thought into how he can humiliate his uncle, and it's just not something that I ever saw Cersei trying to do.
And this is, you know, it's like I question whether it was to humiliate him, but you think in the from what we've seen, the only one that ever opposes Joffrey that's not his father.
Yeah.
Because it's I feel like old Bobby B would have slapped him around a couple times too.
Robert?
Yeah. Because he saw him being a twat on several occasions, and he would have gotten some smackins. But the only one that really gave him anything what for was Tyrion.
Mm-hmm.
But Tyrion struck him several times. So I can buy that he engineered this whole thing as a slight to him, and particularly singled him out for cruelty.
I think so. And I think that's why I have very little sympathy for Joffrey, is not because he's a product of his environment, which he partially is, but because he's made conscious decisions to just be an asshole.
Yeah, but it's like one of those things where, you know, you hear about a vicious dog that gets put down, and dogs are not born vicious.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that. They're made vicious by people, and you always think, well, why don't they put... But on the other hand, it was a vicious dog, and it needed to be put down. So,
yeah,
Joffrey's life was not one of peace and happiness. It was a life of torment and cruelty. So even from that basis, I can't bring myself to feel sorry for him. So there you go. Sheem said, shouldn't Loras be furious with Brienne since he wanted to avenge Renly? I thought Jaime was going to try to broker a peace between the two, but he didn't even mention it. What do you think about that, Jim?
What did Brienne do here that Loras would be furious at?
Just
being nice
up.
To
Because remember, this is something we talked about last week with Margaery, the fact that maybe that scene of them reconciling was to address people like Sheem that would say, you know, I guess we're supposed to read between the lines to say that he's talked to her sister. Her sister said, hey, I talked to Brienne and everything's cool. I mean, she corrected Joffrey. And the other thing is, well, maybe there is still time for a confrontation. We're only the second episode in the season, for God's sakes.
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, is there anything we see in the episode that says Loras isn't mad at Brienne?
Well, that's the other thing is, show Loras does not seem like his shit is overly torn up about Renly's death.
You're right.
Whereas in book, Renly is, you know, almost swears an oath of chastity. He's like, you know, what, I can't remember his quote, but it's like...
Until he sees Oberon, and then it's all over.
Right, once Oberon licks his finger, it's boom. But, so, I don't know, that could be a slight change that just... Show Loras was much more of a an ambitious person that wanted to attach himself to the king. Because even in season one, we see him pushing towards that.
Okay.
You know, you can see them building the foundation of, hey, you should be, you know, you should be the one that wants to put your crown in the ring, so to speak. Josh C said, it looks like a shot we got to fly, the dragon flying over to King's Landing was just a vision that Brandon had when warging into the White Tree. Do you think that vision will come to fruition this season or in season 5 more likely?
Feels too early for this season. I think season 5 is more likely.
Mildly interesting. okay, from here on out, we're talking about murder speculation.
All right, cool.
I cannot guarantee none of these people have read the books.
Okay.
And I cannot comment on what's true and what's not, because that wouldn't be fun.
I will speculate on what's cool
going to be,
and what is true.
I'm going to be mildly interested in all these takes. And I'm not going to give anything away.
Okay.
But these are people that claim they've not read the books, and they've seen the episode, and they have questions. And
well, when your eyes widen like Brienne...
I got a much better poker face than Brian.
Poker face for radio.
Luke P. says, I think Tywin has to be involved in Joff's murder. He had two Valyrian swords for his family, and I think he'd keep one for himself. Why would he give both away? Because he knew he'd get Joff's back by the end of the ceremony. Tywin as I'm trying to think of a not racially offensive term for something giver. He's a boomerang giver.
I don't know. Tywin has seemed to deal with Joffrey and have him on some kind of leash. It's a fairly long leash, but I think he can control him and manipulate him. I don't feel like Tywin would feel the need to take Joffrey out.
Can you imagine? Let's say that Joffrey didn't die. Can you even imagine Tywin coming after him after this is all done?
What do you mean coming after him? Trying to kill him?
Not kill him.
Spank him?
Maybe.
I can imagine a literal spanking.
Like, I can see Tywin having the Kingsguard hold him down, bare-ass naked, while he beats him with the broadside of Widow's Wail.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he was seething throughout this whole thing. Could not believe that his family was being so shamed and dishonored by this boy's behavior.
Yeah, and that's my thing. If we had seen...
Joff might have gotten off easy by being poisoned.
By being killed. If we had seen an episode like this and a scene with Joffrey being as much of a bastard and embarrassing his family as much as he did in this episode before, and then maybe like a couple episodes later he was poisoned, I think maybe we could make a case for Tywin doing it, but I think... he hasn't done anything reckless enough for Tywin to be really seriously worried. And he's taken his quote-unquote advice, which has come in the form of chastising and humiliation, to a large degree. So I think Tywin is not a likely candidate.
All right. Moving on to William S. This is my good buddy Will. I use his Christian name. For the murder suspects, I'd like to drop Sansa's name into the mix. If the poison was in the cup, she's the only one who handled it out of view. I'm hesitant to submit that as a theory because Sansa's really been nothing but a whipping boy /girl since day one. But poison is a pretty passive-aggressive way to knock off someone, so there it is. The fool, meaning Ser Dontus, is my number two contender, and I'd pull all the Tyrells off the list because killing the little shit before consummating the union would leave them without the queen hat. But in the end, who cares? The little fucker's dead, and I got almost giddy watching his eyes bulge and blood spew. On Jaime and Brienne, I'd like to submit that the attraction there is an interesting one. I think for Jaime, it's a relationship where she's almost like his conscious. She has all the sense of duty that Ned did, but because of her lower position and the time they spent together, Jaime sees that she represents part of what he once aspired to be, but does it in a way that is more noble than anyone he's been around. She's primarily as different from Ned in that she serves in her duty, but is compassionate despite what she knows about him. I feel that position is enhanced by her physical stature. Being bigger than everyone is kind of a throwback to Egyptian hieroglyph-style nobility.
Interesting.
What do you think of the murder suspect? He's Ser Dontus and Sansa, and he's off the Tyrells.
Okay, so there is some supporting evidence for that, because when Dontus comes up before Joffrey chokes to death and says, we need to get out of here if you want to live, come on. Come on, he's got something to do with it. He has to. Otherwise, why would he say that to Sansa? Right?
Well, I'm playing devil's advocate.
What other reason do we see in this episode for him to come up and try to get Sansa out of there?
Well, we know he feels somewhat indebted to her for saving his life.
I'm just saying what events are transpiring that her life would be in danger.
The fact that Cersei is calling for her husband to, you know, off with her head.
But she says, the fool, comes up to her before that happens, like as Joffrey is choking. If he didn't know that Joffrey wasn't just choking and was gonna die, I don't think that scene happens. That little interaction. So he's super suspicious. Completely. Okay. I don't know that she is, because she seemed oblivious. And when he comes up, she's like, "What? Oh, we gotta go." I don't know.
That's kind of her three modes, though. She's either excited about the prospect of kissing Joffrey and getting lemon cakes, oblivious, or extremely sad.
True.
We haven't seen much of the former Sansa of late. What about his takes? We talked a lot about Jaime, and so I'm going to leave those comments about her and Brienne to stand on their own. Robbie J said that the 33:44 mark of the episode, during the ceremony, we get an ominous shot of four prominent wedding guests seated behind Margaery just as the priest utters words, "Cursed be he who would tear them asunder." I'm going to poison Robbie J, and his eyes bug out, and he's gasped for breath, because we already considered this point.
We did.
That's my new thing. Because I assemble the feedback, and I never know quite what we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
So if I start reading feedback that we've already considered, I'm going to say you got poisoned.
You're going to let Robbie J eat pie?
Robbie J, you just got fell victim to some dry pie. Anthony B says, to me, the Bieber King's assassin.
Do we think this is a point in the Beaver King? That's nice. This is a good question, though. Do we think it was the pie or the wine that did it? Because I think there
that pie was lethal to pigeons. We know that. Several dead ones.
I don't know that the pie was
nibbling. Oh, but do you not know?
You're right. I don't know. I don't know that. I feel like that's a good question, though, because certain people had access to the pie, certain people had access to the wine, and those are different sets of people.
Yeah, so,
I can't ask you.
Yeah,
but
don't fuck with pigeons is all I got to say.
Apparently.
Anthony B says, to me, the Bieber King's assassination looks like a plot between Tywin, Cersei, and Jaime. They all have the most to gain from the situation, with an uncontrollable Joffrey out of the way and a very controllable Tommen soon to be seated on the throne. The Tyrells are now minimized as Margaery is no longer the consort.
If that's the case, and Cersei was in on this, she did a hell of a job acting like she wasn't.
Ice cold.
Yeah.
Ice cold.
And Jaime, like both of them, I don't know. I can't possibly see
Could you buy this as a Tywin maneuver with Jaime being Jaime and Cersei being patsies?
I that there's any reason for that.
Okay.
I mean, if it came out that it was that,
I guess that's true.
I guess I could buy it, but they'd need a strong reason why.
All right. Inver M says, I'm leaning more towards the Tyrells as the main culprits, but I'm still not ruling out Ser Dontus or any combination of Olenna, Margaery, Dontus, and Andor, all three. The reason I say so is, after Joffrey orders Tyrion to kneel, Margaery breaks the tension by pointing to the pigeon pie, and Joffrey hands her his cup. Mm-hmm. She places on the table right next to Lady Olenna. It's very subtle and quick, but the two exchange a look. When Joffrey is choking, Lady Olenna is the first one to yell out, "Help the poor boy!" I have no idea what motivation the Tyrells would have to eliminate Joffrey, since they hadn't consummated their marriage yet, and you would think they would have nothing to gain and everything to lose. What happens to Margaery? Does she have any power whatsoever? Who succeeds Joffrey? Cersei would have total control over him as opposed to Joffrey.
Huh. Yeah, so I would say that they are likely candidates, but they haven't consummated that marriage yet. That's a weird play.
It seemed to be a high risk play.
Like, I don't know what's to gain from it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to poison, why do it there?
Why not wait a couple of days until he has a feast and then kill him?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I certainly think that Margaery knows Joffrey really well and realizes what a bastard he is. And I use the bastard not in the sense of the word that they use.
Although he is that as well.
He is that. I mean, maybe Margaery realizes that this guy is no good for the kingdom, but it raises the question, why do it there? Why do it at that time? That seems crazy to me. I really want to know, like, it seems like whoever did this used Donatos as their messenger, at least, and is loyal to Sansa, and that sheds light, or at least that puts into the spotlight Olenna, because she's really the only one who's been a friend to Sansa this entire time and has cared about Sansa. And so if Elaena knew this was going down because she did it, then she could tell Donatos to get Sansa out of there before the shit goes down.
All right.
Who else would want Sansa out of there? Dantus, I guess, himself would want her out of there. Maybe it's just him.
All right, Matthew P. is repping your dry pie theory. It seems that everyone is leaping to the conclusion that it is the wine that killed Joffrey, but I'd actually wager it was the giant pie. If you think about it, unless Tyrion somehow poisoned the new glass of wine or the fresh glass was poisoned off-screen when Joffrey briefly let it leave his sight, the entire pitcher would have to have been poisoned, which would have killed others as well. But Joffrey was the only person to eat any of the cake, slash pie. He died before others even got a taste. Also, after his first bite, he had a distinct look of suspicion on his face that he holds for almost 3 full seconds while chewing. He then takes a few subtle, deep, gasping breaths and yells for Tyrion to bring his wine, complaining that the pie is dry, afterwards stating, "Ah, good, needs washing down." Not the best of metaphors, but the dead doves inside the pie after it was sliced open could also symbolize the lethality of the pie.
Yeah. That's a good theory. I like that I think the pie is the culprit here.
The deadly DDP. It's the deadly dry pie. The deadly DDP.
The other question is, I guess, is there a kind of ceremony to this whole ceremony? Is there a ritual that goes on where Joffrey eats the pie first? Because if that's the case, then you can make a really strong argument for it that they knew he would eat the pie first versus like Marjorie, who could potentially have eaten the pie first.
That's
she had
question.
It in her hand.
I don't have anything but Western, our present Western marriage customs to go on. Which,
yeah, same here.
So,
okay, I think the dry pie theory is a good one. I like it.
Tony T said, just before Joff makes Tyrion his cupbearer, Lady Tyrell approached Sansa at the wedding party's table. She touches Sansa's hair while talking about Robb. She then touches the necklace that Sansa's wearing. At the 3255 mark of the show, by the HBO Go counter, you can clearly see the necklace is out of place and now missing one of the pendants near Sansa's collarbone. So did Lady Tyrell pickpocket Sansa, or was this an oversight by the costume people on set? What the hell fell out of the pie after Joff hit it? When the servants picked up the massive pie, there was a wedge missing and something fell out. It looked like a bird head.
Yeah, probably.
We know there's
was.
A lot of dead birds in there. Yeah. If there's a little smash cut to the inside of the pie where they either nibbled on the dry pie and got poisoned, or the widow's wail.
Either or.
Added a few more pigeon widows to its list of whalees.
Yeah, I think a pigeon head falling out is appropriate. What was the first half of that again?
The fact that this, when Lady Olenna approaches Sansa to commiserate with
her. With her necklace.
She fusses kind of over her, and they're saying that when they show a close-up of the necklace, there's a pendant missing.
I don't know if there's a pendant missing. I'm sure people have looked at this a lot closer than I have. I rewound that scene many, many times to see if I could tell if there's supposed to be a symmetrical pendant on the other side. Her hair is covering it. I can't tell. I guess if I went back to previous episodes, I would be able to tell, but I didn't have time and I didn't have the inclination either to do that. So.
Alrighty. James H. said, I work in post-production.
But to what end? To what end? My question is.
Like, this is the question.
Pickpocket, not even pickpocket, pick neck this girl, ripping a pendant off of that necklace without her noticing while fondling her hair seems very difficult, even for someone with sleight of hand skills. And to what end? Why? Why take a pendant? That says nothing about the poisoning of the king. It says nothing about getting her out of there.
What do you mean?
I'm under the assumption that Elaena told...
Well, I think the implication is that the gem was either the poison itself or a vial containing it, that this is something they worked out in advance. Yeah, it's just not that she just stole
the Dantos
gem.
Gave her the necklace with a gem full of poison. She goes up, she pulls the poison off, and she dumps it into a cup.
I think that's what they're saying.
Or into the pie.
Or in the dry pie.
Oh, man, that's something. That's really something. I don't know. That seems really far-fetched.
All right. Shall we move on to the next one, the final?
Sure.
James H. says, I work in post-production, and I do a lot of sound design for television. I noticed there was a very subtle clink as Lady Olenna walks back to her seat in front of Joffrey. It's a wide shot where Lady Olenna moves from left to right as is briefly blocked by a juggler. If you listen to the soundscape of the scene, it's oddly quiet and normal. There's some low crowd noises and sounds of flaming juggling. God, that damn it, flaming juggling. Just get the fuck out of my face with that flaming juggling.
Let's throw gold at him.
But then you hear a short, glassy clink. That's what it was. Sir Aeron was there, and that clink was the gold coin hitting them in the skull.
It might have been Jamie knocking over a glass with his hand.
There's at least three clinks per minute at this party. He was just, oh, excuse me, sorry. It's just one. There's some low crowd noises and sounds of flaming juggling, but then you hear a short, glassy clink break the mood. You can also make the argument that it was just a toast somewhere off camera or in the crowd, but to me, it seems way too deliberate in an effect choice over a way too important a moment to not be the Queen of Thorns dropping a stone in a goblet.
Huh. People are really harping on this
Westerosi CSI, baby.
Sure.
Enhance.
Yeah. It's got me a little worried that some of these people might know a little too much. I don't know. I didn't hear the clinking.
Well, we had a lot of feedback on this, and I called, the rules is first one to get a theory in gets it on the show, and this was the broadest selection of all the theories that I could to get.
Yeah. All right. I don't know. I didn't hear the sound, and I feel like somehow Dantos and Olenna are connected, and the fact that Dantos tries to get Sansa out of there feels like maybe Olenna had something to do with it. But why? I'm not sure.
All right. Well, that's all we got for the main section of the cast.
Okay.
To preserve your spoiler virginity. Although I think people, in the first couple seasons, they're referring to people as sweet summer childs, which was kind of insulting. I've noticed that in the Game of Thrones wiki or Reddit, they're taking to calling non-book readers the Unsullied, which I think is a lot less patronizing. To preserve your Unsullied outlook, we're going to excuse you from the spoiler process.
Okay.
And if you'd like to send us more emails, you can do so at gameofthrones@baldmove.com. You can always follow along with us and find out the latest information on when our shows drop and stuff of that nature at facebook.com/baldmove. And Twitter at baldmove, baldmove.com. That's all I got to say. Anything else, Jim?
No, that's it.
We will see you this weekend for episode 3 on Sunday night. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Bald Move.
I will see you in the spoiler section. Watch it all come around as I lay on the ground. Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn Payne the Hound. They all think I'm lost, but I know where I'm found. I'm the blood in the north when it all comes down. My word is my bond, and my bond is my word. Valar to Harris, all men must serve. See as a raven flies, and time slips by. Valar my rulers, all men must die. All men must die. Hey, welcome back to the spoiler section. We've dismissed Jim from the room, it's just you and me. Some things I wanted to point out to our book readers is the fact that talk of Jon Snow being half Stark, and a threat, I think has interesting implications for people to subscribe to the Grand Northern Conspiracy theory, which we'll be talking about, if all goes well, in a few weeks. It's basically a theory that the Northern Lords are unified, and some of the River Lords, to plot to put either Rickon Stark or Jon Snow as King of the North, if not place him on the Iron Throne eventually. But it recognizes that there is the possibility that Jon Snow is as dangerous as a pure-blooded Stark. And also might be a hint about, you know, in the books, Rob legitimizes John and names him as his heir in a letter that is signed before a few of his lords. And people have wondered, you know, who the survive the Red Wedding might still know about that. Where is that letter? Is that going to come into play later on in the series? We'll have to see. The other one that I want to talk about is Cold Hands, the character. it just doesn't seem like we're going to get around to him. I know that there's a lot of rumors about him not appearing in the series. A lot of people were still holding out hope that he would. But I feel like this vision of the brand got, that the Bloodraven character, the last screen seer, he can steer Bran right into his location wherever he wants, just using the Weirwood network that Bran has shown the ability to plug into. So I thought that was interesting and kind of hints on how the Double D's are going to tell the story going forward. Let's get right into the spoiler feedback. Nathan P. said, this is in reference to the purple... talking about the purple wedding, why they call it the purple wedding. We talked about the royal color purple. I think I forgot to mention the fact that people speculated that it was the color of Joff's face. But it's also a reference to the purple amethyst worn by Sansa Stark, which disguised the strangler poison, which was taken by Lady Olenna. She's seen playing with Sansa's hair and then added to his wine, the goblet that he places right next to her. Thus, this is the stranger. Thus, as victims of the strangler said to go deep purple color, it's another reason why the wedding is called purple. So there you go. Tyler S. also mentions there's some interesting things that they're going doing with Shay. I'm starting to fear that they aren't going to kill her off. I predict Cersei or Tywin will find her, and she will testify at Tyrion's trial just like in the book, except now she'll be the tragic spurned lover instead of the gold-digging whore. Even if Tyrion finds her in Tywin's bed, Tyrion will not be justified in killing her in the eyes of most viewers. Worst case scenario, Tyrion and Shay reconcile, escape together, and she takes the role of Penny in future seasons. I am not a big fan of that theory because I am obviously not a big fan of Shay. I also see the truth of your central argument, which is if she testifies against Tyrion the way he treated her in this episode, a lot of viewers are going to be shocked that Tyrion could kill her. There's some brutality there. The other way it could go is you find out that Tywin is strangling Shay. The Tywin's literally, instead of the grand reveal being that Tywin is a hypocrite and has been horned up the whole time, or at least we're left to consider that. You know, a lot of people are talking about how Tywin might have made use of the tunnels of the Hand's quarters back when he was serving for the Mad King. And the fact that one of those tunnels goes right to a whorehouse is kind of interesting, if true. But instead of him being a hypocrite, he actually is maybe motivated by rage or, you know, wanting revenge for his son and strangles him there, which would then really make Tyrion give him the motivation to be the Kinslayer, in addition to the motivation he has. It's arguable that Book Tyrion is kind of an asshole after this experience with Shay and King's Landing, and the show might want to preserve a little bit of more viewer sympathy and not have him murder, you know, his father just because, you know, he's mad at him taking his girlfriend. And I mean, I'm not saying Book Tyrion's not justified. I'm just saying that he walks in and Tyrion's choking Shay, or has killed Shay, or has hung Shay, as he swore he'd do after he testified against her. That would make Tyrion even more righteous in the viewer's eyes. So I'm going to go like from the opposite angle from you there, Tyler, and say that they could do it that way. And I don't know that it has any repercussions on how we feel about Tywin, because, you know, obviously we know what happens to him immediately after. But if they do it your way, which it seems likely, I can't see how the viewers are not going to be a little seeing Tyrion in a more distasteful light, which maybe that's what the Double D's want. We'll have to see. I'm interested in find out. I'm mildly interested to find out what happens. Bran and Theon are diving headfirst into Dance of Dragons territory. True. Either their storylines will greatly be expanded or book readers are going to start getting spoiled soon. Then again, Bran pretty much disappears from the books. The Double D's could get him into to the Three-Eyed Crow this season and put his story on hold indefinitely. And as few chapters as Theon has in Dance of Dragons, quite a bit happens, so they could definitely spend some time in Moat Cailin and Winterfell. I'm very interested because I'm kind of shocked at how much stuff that they're getting into with Dance and Feast. I really thought they'd get a year's worth of material out of both of those books, but it seems like we're only going to get a season and a half, roughly, out of both of the books combined, which is somewhat shocking. But yeah, and it just depends on what they do with Danny's story and how much they do with the whole Griff storyline and John Connington and Aegon. There's so much stuff up in the air and so much action left to resolve. You know, just going by the episode titles, we're not going to get to the Oberon and the Mountain duel until episode 8 or 9. So there's still plenty of story left, but it does seem like they're going to plow through all of Feast and all of Dance of Dragons by the end of next season, which is kind of shocking. And if I was George R. R. Martin, I'd be kind of shitting my pants. Peter from Ireland says, after watching Olenna at the wedding stealing one of the jewels from Sansa's necklace, I couldn't help but think we're going to need a spinoff show about Olenna and Huel from Breaking Bad as they roam Westeros as master pickpockets. Indeed. And I had a real, me and Jim had a kind of a spirited debate, especially since I couldn't really tell him everything, about whether to treat those as spoilers or not, the evidence from the show. And his argument is, they're not really spoilers unless it's a book reader telling you, yeah, that's the right theory. And I tried to do a good job presenting 4 or 5 theories in the same, you know, kind of the same time, and not, you know, trying to play devil's advocate there a couple places pretty hard, and not lend the weight to any one or the other. You know, because it is, it's all there on the screen. It's not something that's based on the future. We're just talking about stuff that's happened on screen. So I know that there's probably still some people that would consider that mild spoilers, which is why we eventually ended up just putting them at the end of the feedback section and warning people what we're going to talk about, and hopefully they'll be happy with it. Anyway, moving on to the tinfoil theory of the week, and I'm excited about this one. It's probably going to be a little shorter than the other ones, but I think it is a very exciting theory. It was a lot harder for me to compile, and in fact, I'm hoping it doesn't come across as a jumbled mess, because it's not so much a logical, you know, this, and then this, and then this, so this. It's more like, here's a bunch of things, nebulous things, circumstantial things that point to one conclusion. And then I'm going to have to talk about, you know, the contra evidence as well. But let me lay it on you. Tyrion Lannister is secretly a Targaryen bastard born of the illicit union between the Mad King Aerys and Joanna Lannister, who's Tywin's wife. So, what's the evidence here? First and foremost, according to Sir Barristan Selmy, King Aerys II lusted after Joanna Lannister. That's something that caused friction between the king and his hand. We know that they had a falling out of sorts, and eventually Tywin came and sacked King's Landing and murdered his whole family. But this all began at the wedding of Tywin to Joanna. Aerys drunkenly japed about how it was a pity that the first night tradition was banned. First night, of course, is something we see like in the movie Braveheart. Roose Bolton talks about it in the books, where basically the lord of the land gets the first right when any man marries a woman in his realm. He gets the right to have, you know, to deflower her first or have a first go at her. Mainly apocryphal. I don't know that this actually was a right in the real world. It seems like it's designed to piss people off. But anyway, he joked about that, and Sir Barristan sensitively says he took certain liberties in the bedding ritual when the men at the feast had to disrobe the bride. Then in Meereen, when Dany asks Sir Barristan about her father and whether there's a woman he loved better than his queen, Sir Barristan replies, "Not loved, mayhaps wanted is a better word, but..." And he trailed off. "It was only kitchen gossip, the whispers of washerwoman and stable boys." So this sets the phase that, or sets the idea that if Aerys had the means and the opportunity, that he would either force himself upon Joanna. But we also know that before he went total Targ crazy, that Aerys was actually a very charming a man as well. So some people speculate that this might have been a willing union because Tywin is completely whipped by Joanna and she had a lot of power over him. It could be that, you know, she also put the horns on him as well. She cuckolded him. So some other evidence in the Game of Thrones novelization, one of the chapters of Jon Snow from his POV, he describes Tyrion thusly. Said he has one green eye and one black eye that peered out from under a lank fall of hair, so blonde it seemed white. A couple things here. Blonde hair, we know, is a consistent Lannister trait, as well as the green eyes. But platinum blonde hair, this white gold hair, really only seems to be within the Targaryen genetics. And it seems unlikely that the cousins Tywin and Joanna would both somehow be carriers of this Targaryen gene. As far as his eyes, you could see, you know, one being green, one being black. Targaryens have violet eyes, purple eyes. However, we also know from the Duncan Egg Chronicles that Aegon, who's the egg in the Duncan Egg storyline, was described as having eyes so dark purple that they appeared black, unless in bright light. Now, Tyrion is also described as having a jutting forehead and a prominent brow, which would imply that maybe his eyes are more or less shadowed all the time. It could be that people are mistaking this black eye, or a deep purple eye for a black eye. And people are saying that would literally make him half Targaryen. So that's one piece of physical evidence. Also, there is some interesting information, again, in the same chapter, where Jon talks to Tyrion. And I'm going to quote that here, and this is from Tyrion's point of view, the second chapter of Tyrion's point of view. It says, "The boy has absorbed all this in silence. He had the stark face, if not the name, long, solemn, guarded, a face that gave nothing away. Whoever his mother had been, she had left little of herself and her son. 'What are you reading about?' he asked. 'Dragons,' Tyrion told him. 'What good is that? There are no more dragons,' the boy said with an easy certainty of youth. 'So they say,' Tyrion replied. 'Sad, isn't it? When I was your age, I used to dream of having a dragon of my own.' 'You did?' the boy said suspiciously. Perhaps he thought Tyrion was making fun of him. 'Oh, yes. Even a stunted, twisted, ugly little boy can look down over the world when he's seated on a dragon's back.' Tyrion pushed the bearskin aside and climbed to his feet. 'I used to start fires in the bowels of Casterly Rock and stare at the flames for hours, pretending they were dragonfire. Sometimes I'd imagine my father burning. At other times, my sister.' Jon Snow was staring at him, a look equal parts horror and fascination. Tyrion guffawed. 'Don't look at me that way, bastard. I know your secret. You've dreamt the same kind of dreams.'" There's a couple ways you can interpret this, right? One is the dreams, specifically that he shared with Jon, are the ones where he wants revenge against his family. And we see in the previous episode, and we know from Jon's point of view, that there was some jealousy and some anger and some bitterness and resentment about his bastardry. But another way to look at it is maybe Tyrion was literally being true, and that they both dreamed of riding dragons and having dragon dreams, which is another Targaryen trait. We see Tyrion, you know, as a young boy, having these fantasies of being on a dragon, riding a dragon. Could that be indicative as of his Targaryen blood and his desire to, you know, be more Targaryen than Lannister? Also, in A Dance with Dragons, again in the second Tyrion POV chapter, he talks about, reminisces about his youth. He says, "When he was still a lonely child in the depths of Casterly Rock, he often rode dragons through the nights, pretending he was some lost Targaryen princeling or Valyrian dragon lord, soaring high o'er a field and mountains. Once, when his uncles asked him what gift he wanted for his name day, he begged them for a dragon. 'It wouldn't need to be a big one, it could be little like I am.' His uncle Jarian thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard, but his uncle Tygut said, 'The last dragon died a century ago, lad.' That seemed so monstrously unfair that the boy had cried himself to sleep that night." So there again, circumstantial physical evidence, circumstantial psychological evidence, perhaps seen as foreshadowing on Martin's part. But let's talk about some similarities to Aerys's other offspring. First of all, we know Tyrion very much is very bookish, nerdy, and he shares that quality with Rhaegar. Rhaegar also was described in his youth as very bookish. Something that Viserys told Dany is that Targaryens are very hearty, that they're resistant to heat, they don't burn, they don't get sick like common folk. We see in the books that Dany has this in spades. You know, she doesn't catch fire when and die on Drogon's pyre. She doesn't come down with the Pale Mare, even though she spends a lot of time cavorting with sick people. And Tyrion also shares this trait. We see him fall into the Roin, wrestling with someone inflicted with the grayscale, and he comes up unscathed, not affected. Poor John Connington just barely reaches in with his hands for a few seconds and gets afflicted. Now, there's a lot of people to tell you correctly that Viserys was a dumbass and had a lot of facts wrong about a great many things, including his own blood. A lot of people point out that Targaryens did, in fact, die. Some of the Duncan Egg Chronicles and other works talk about a spring sickness that befell the realm one year, and several people in the Targaryen dynasty died. So, and also you got the vagaries of disease, right? Sometimes, you know, Spanish influenza, a lot of people died, but a great many people didn't. And this, a lot of people that were in the same families and shared close living spaces and doctors and nurses treating people didn't get sick. It's not an automatic death sentence for sickness and disease. But this, what's called on the internet, the tinfoil boards, is Targaryen super immunity. If true, and we also know that Martin doesn't quite follow the rules of genetics and science to a T. I mean, Robert Baratheon, all of his kids basically had the same hair and eyes. That is wildly improbable to the point of being impossible, but he wanted to be that, and he's like, you know, you can't really get out Punnett squares and draw up the genetics. Maybe this super immunity is something that's genetic that's passed down to offspring as well. One other commonality, Rhaego, which was Dany's stillborn child, was born stunted, twisted, and deformed. In fact, Miri Maz Durr, which I think is how you pronounce the witch's name, described him as thus. He said, he's monstrous, twisted. I pulled him out myself. He was scaled like a lizard, blind with leather wings like the wings of a bat. When I touched him, his skin fell from his bones. Inside, he was full of grave worms. So that's pretty bad. Also seen, and maybe the black magic that was at work during Dany's birth caused this to happen, made this transformation to some half-dragon baby. But also, she could just be exaggerating or making stuff up, or we could have a baby with mild deformities and she's overreacting. We saw a similar thing, interestingly enough, with Tyrion himself. A description that Prince Oberyn, of all people, gives of Tyrion, because he was excited to go see him when he was a baby because he heard all these crazy things about him. And he tells Tyrion, Tyrion wants to know, well, what did you hear about me? And he starts to tell him, he said, you were said to have a tail, a stiff, curly tail like a swine's. Your head was monstrously huge, we heard, half again the size of your body. And you've been born with thick black hair and a beard besides, an evil eye and lion's claws. Your teeth were so long you could not close your mouth, and between your legs were a girl's privates as well as a boy. So, we know that all that is not literally true about Tyrion. He was a dwarf, and, you know, was stunted as far as his physicality, had the mix-match eyes, but he wasn't a monster, didn't have a tail, didn't have, you know, giant fangs or lion's claws. So there's precedent in, it could be that this Durr woman was just misinformed or exaggerating to effect. But if he did have some kind of physical deformity, or if, say, he was just born as dwarfism and she's making it out to be worse than it was, just like the legends that were coming out of the Castle Rock at the time of Tyrion's birth, this is another thing that the Targaryen descendants would have in common. There's also Tywin himself, why does he hate Tyrion so much? And this is, you know, goes back from the fact that, you know, he said he murdered his wife, but, you know, why is there so much hostility there? And we see in the show, he says, I cannot prove that you are not mine. In the book, he outright says, you are no son of mine. Now, he's got cause for saying this. The last thing he said was when Tyrion was murdering him. But we still, it's pretty strong evidence, you know, if you just go straight from a textual reading. Evidence against, you know, Tyrion's parentage in the book is never once disputed, other than by Tywin himself in these moments of kind of distress. In fact, Lady Guinna, who is Tywin's sister, was talking to Jaime about, you know, which child was most like Tywin. She says, Jaime, he said, tugging on his ear, sweetling, I've known you since you were a babe at Joanna's breast. You smile like Garion and you fight like Tig, and there's some of Kevin in you, else you would not wear the cloak. But Tyrion is Tywin's son, not you. I said so once to your father's face, and he would not speak to me for half a year. Men are such thundering great fools, even the sort who come along once in a thousand years, speaking of Tywin. So Tywin's own sister says that Tyrion, if not in looks, at least in disposition and mental faculties and cunning, is Tywin's son. Now, tellingly, that doesn't have anything to do with genetics. That could be entirely upbringing and his book smart, his education. So I don't think that's conclusive proof, no. A lot of people say that if Tywin did know of Joanna's liaison with Aerys, that that would explain his enmity against Tyrion, and that he would not want him to inherit Castle Rock at all costs, because if it ever came out that he was a bastard, then, you know, the whole family could lose out on Castle Rock. But, you know, there's also the possibility that Tywin didn't know. And there's also the possibility that this is all bullshit, and these are all his legitimately born children. There's also another interesting theory that says that Cersei and Jaime are Targaryens. Same deal, that Aerys got them onto Joanna. They're born. That explains their blonde hair, explains their proclivities to want to sleep with each other, because that's a Targaryen trait, apparently. So they've got this theory that Tywin is either wittingly or unwittingly raising this entire brood of cuckoo type Targaryens for Aerys in his stead. Now, where is all this going? Well, Tyrion is one of the common theories for being one of the three heads of the dragon. If the R plus L equals J theory is true, that would make Jon Targaryen, Daenerys obviously Targaryen. Tyrion, if he's a Targaryen, that would be something that would kind of unify them all as the three heads of the dragon that was prophesied and promised that so intrigued Rhaegar. Something interesting else that all three have in common. Jon Snow, when he was given birth to, killed his mother. Daenerys, when she was born, her mother also died in childbirth. Tyrion Lannister was born, killed his mother during childbirth. There's some interesting parallels to the Azor Ahai story here as well. That's the story about the man who forged Lightbringer, the sword. He first, you know, he worked on the sword for, I'm going to get the days wrong, but 30 days and 30 nights, went to quench the sword in a bucket of water, and the sword shattered. Then he worked on the steel sword for 60 days and 60 nights. He went to quench it into a live lion's chest, shattered apart. Worked for it 90 days and 90 nights, then realized that he had to pay the ultimate sacrifice, quenched it in his wife's chest, which I believe her name was Nisa, and it finally started glowing as if on fire, and that was the weapon that was able to turn back the Long Winter and defeat the others. A lot of people are saying that that symbolizes all three of these people's mothers dying, that they literally are collectively Lightbringer, that also ties into Three Heads of the Dragon. The Three Heads of the Dragon are Lightbringer, and these three with their dragons are going to be what turns the tide of the battle against the others. I think it's an interesting theory. Kind of on the fence on this one. Lots of circumstantial evidence, lots of what you could see foreshadowing. If GRRM thought he kind of shot his wad with the L plus R equals J theory, then I could see that maybe he wants to launch this A plus J equals T to give the back nine of the golf course, which is his Westerosi series, a little bit of juice as well. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it as well doing all the research. And if you got any recommendations on theories or any ones that you've come up with yourself, send them in to me at GameOfThrones@baldmove.com, and I look forward to talking to you next week.